All right. In peace.
Very good. Yeah, we need it. Good afternoon, everyone. Commissioner Mark Samlin here. As we kick off our resiliency meeting October 23rd, joined by my colleagues, Commissioner Alamon, Commissioner Malikoff, Ms. Torrienti, Betsy Wheaton, and we also have joining us here is Rafael Paz. Welcome, Rafael, to the team, as well as Michelle Rodriguez. We have a busy agenda here, so we're gonna make our way through it. As my colleagues probably recall, we've extended our meeting now till 4 o'clock because we got things to talk about. We are going to start by talking about the Palm Hibiscus project. We have some guests from the county, so we want to make sure we get to that right away. We'll bounce around a little in the agenda because I know some folks are coming in at certain times. For example, UM coming at 3 o'clock. Let me just first ask Elizabeth if she has any announcements on the items, please.
Thank you. We don't have any announcements at this time.
Okay. Any items that are deferred? Do you want to call that out?
The agenda reflects the items that are deferred. We have no additional items that are deferred that are not on the list. Do you want me to read out the list of deferred items?
Yeah, would you please?
Sure. So deferred items include discussion requiring all commercial landscapers working on Miami Beach to abide by Florida-friendly landscaping standards. We're in the process of working with code compliance and our finance department to ensure that any requirements that are set forth in that ordinance help streamline and are efficient, so we hope to bring that back in December. Discussion on repurposing our golf courses for the future. This is an ongoing discussion that there'll be quarterly updates. Discussion pertaining to amendments to the city code regarding.
I'm sorry. Elizabeth. Those are fine. So we're gonna for the items that were on the agenda. Number 12, the commercial landscaping, we're deferring, and then per discussion with Commissioner Steinberg, given time in the agenda, we're gonna defer item number 10.
Perfect.
Wonderful. Let's see. Of course, the public meeting, we'll hear from various folks, but always the public is welcome, and that's part of why we're here. And here we also have a little bit of a special day because this is the last time I think this group of three will be sitting together
at least on this side of the desk.
On this side of the desk. We'll be sitting in other places. So I just want to take a second and thank both of my colleagues, Commissioner Malikoff, who came back and acted like she had never been here and making important contributions, and because of her background was able to really help move us along. And it's also been a pleasure working with Commissioner Alamon. You see her name all over many of the important ordinances works. We've worked together as a good team. We've agreed on things, we've disagreed on things, but we've always made it about the policy and done it in a respectful way. So I just want to thank them for all their contributions, and I want to recognize them as well.
Thank
so thank you.
You.
Thank you.
Oh my goodness. Wow, this is a lot of swag in here.
There you go.
Wow.
And they are very environmentally friendly. They really are. They really are.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Actually, since it's campaign season, I think that it's important to know, you know, Mark and I ran against each other. And I said this on social media, and I really feel that it's true. Mm-hmm. It's hard when you run against each other not to develop during the course of a campaign, like a little bit of tension between you. But I hope that our relationship can set an example for all the commissioners to follow, because Mark is an incredibly intelligent guy, very thorough, very analytical. He studies everything. He's very open-minded, talks to everyone. And I've got a lot of respect for him. To me, we have a very small city. And everyone that throws their name in the hat to try to be a commissioner is really making personal sacrifices. And they're obviously leaders in our community, so we want to keep each other close and keep good relationships. And being a commissioner isn't about polarizing people and becoming enemies with people. It's about building relationships and bringing everybody in. And so it's been a pleasure to serve with you. I'm glad we were able to do that, and I'm glad we've become friends. And thank you for the lovely present.
Thank you. Very, very kind. All right, now we'll roll up our sleeves. We're going to start with Palm Hibiscus, which I think we're going to have to spend a little time with. It's fairly detailed and technical. Here's how I'd like to approach it. I believe we have a representative from the residents, and that's always where we want to start. I'm then going to look to the county, and very pleased that the director of Durham, Lee Hefty, is here. Also, Commissioner Higgins, and they'll probably tag team it a little bit. We'll then have comments from the administration. I think that'll come from Eric Carpenter, and then we'll open it up for the public as well. So, with that, Pierre, if you would give us a little sense of what is on your mind from representing the residents of Palm Hibiscus.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, commissioners, everybody, good afternoon. My name is Pierre D'Agostini. I'm the executive director for Palm Hibiscus and Star Island Homeowner Association. You know, I feel like in the movie when it says, here we are again. So here we are again. We were here a couple of weeks ago to give you a status, and the status has somewhat involved. We are delighted about the fact that we have the budget and for the landscape. That's thanks to your resolution moving forward. We would just like to know when it will start and when it will hopefully be finished, because that gives something to the residents to be looking forward to it. Now, as you know, we still have a lot of issues. One of them is the issue of the roadway project. On the issue of the roadway project, when you speak with CIP, they explain to us that they are still waiting for the plans with the seal and approved by the surveyors. So apparently there's a deadlock right here, and there's a deadlock which has been going on for a few weeks, if not a few months. And I urge the city, the new commissioners, to look into it, because there has to be a reason why those plans have not been delivered yet to the city. Therefore, the roadway project on that aspect is stopped. On the underground project, I mean. On the roadway project, the issue is the harmonization. The issue is the harmonization, and until the harmonization is resolved, there's about 91 houses on Palm Island that are affected. There's about 18 housing on Hibiscus Island. And the harmonization is moving very slowly. At the last meeting, we talked about the fact that Durham was to give their advice, their opinion. It has been long coming forward. When Durham gives their opinion, and I have personally been the witness on being on different properties, including my own, by the way, in which it seems to me like the recommendation doesn't make sense, because apparently where Durham is suggesting to eventually put the drainage doesn't seem like it will technically have the impact on where the drainage is. In addition to the city of Miami Beach have changed, there was first plans that the drainage will be in front of the houses, now the drainage is inside the houses. So I think I urge two things. One, to work with Durham. Now, with all due respect to the city, doing the homework, I realized that maybe it's not so much the city that has the pool with Durham, but it's so much the county. So we have, if I understand correctly, we have a commissioner that represents us of District 5, Mrs.
Right
Higgins.
Right, yeah, she's right there.
Perfect. Delighted to meet you. We have a lot of work to do. One of them, we count on you to work, you and your office to work on Durham, because obviously that is a major issue that we are currently having. The second issue is, I think it's a question of also realizing how it can be expedited. Now the date when we talk undercover, I was going to say, with some of the employees, they don't whisper, but you guess that the date in which the harmonization might be finished is now June 2020. That's might. And the reason is very simple. You have a lot of properties. Each property are very different. So you need to have a plan per property that has been basically backed up by engineer to realize if it actually will be effective. And unfortunately, then it has to be a permit. I know that the city is going to bundle the permits together for at least 20 houses at a time. But the point is, this is going, it's handless. So we are into that handless harmonization situation, which obviously is putting a hole on the roadway. So on the underground, on the east side of Hibiscus, we have been halted by the fact that the city doesn't have the plan. On the harmonization, there has been a wait due to the intervention of Durham, and due to the fact that, by definition, it's very complicated to harmonize 91 properties that are very different. So on those two issues alone, I really would like to urge you really to get it moving, because it's getting to be a painful experience. And I don't think it's the experience that we want the city of Miami to project. Those islands should be a shining example of what leadership in a city like Miami Beach, which is threatened by rising water, can do. So they could be an example over the world. We keep speaking about what the Dutch has done. Okay, they've done a great job, but why not speak about what the city of Miami Beach has been doing and take the example of Palm Hibiscus and Star Island as an example.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pierre. Well put. And thank you for you and your residents and the patience you've shown through this process. I think the news on landscaping, and we can get you the specifics, is going to be a positive one. Maybe Eric will speak about that. But some of the other issues are what we're here to do today about roadways. So thank you for that. Our committee has, as I introduce our colleagues here from the county, our committee has clearly put a focus on the neighborhood improvement projects. Those are really the heart and soul of our resiliency efforts. And so we've started to get updates on these projects. Clearly, the Palm Hibiscus project is a very important one. And as we've gotten those updates, it became very clear that things were not moving the way we would like. And Commissioner Aleman vocalized that. I know my colleague, Commissioner Malikoff, wants to see progress, too. So we sort of got to the point where it was becoming clear for some reason, and we didn't exactly know what, it was not moving in a manner which we were comfortable. And the problem is our residents, like Pierre, are stuck. Several weeks ago, I went out, I did a site visit, I was there with Pierre, I got the tour, and I could just feel something wasn't exactly right. And so we need to move the ball forward, and as Pierre referenced, Commissioner Higgins, who is such a friend of Miami Beach and a friend of mine, is obviously involved because it's her district. So I basically reached out to her and said, you know, how do we work together to move forward? And she said, you know, probably the best thing would be to bring Lee Hefty, who's the director of Durham, and his team to come talk to us. So I'd like to invite you, Lee, to come up and maybe just give a little background on what the situation is, what sort of you need from Miami Beach to move the ball forward here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the board. Lee Hefty, director of Durham with Miami-Dade County. So maybe I'll start with a little bit of background and why is Durham even involved in this. Under the county's regulations, if you are building drainage systems that discharge to surface waters, you need a permit from the county. So for the roadway project that included a drainage system, the city of Miami Beach needed a permit. The city came to the county for the roadway project and got a permit, and they started construction on the roadway. What came after that, I suspect, was a decision at the city that they needed some additional drainage associated with the roadway permit, and there was work that was done without approval of the county. It's work that does require county approval prior to it being done, and what we understand is on the order of 1 to 200 drains got installed on the properties along the roadway without Durham review and approval. We've been working with the city for about the last year trying to get details on how they want that drainage system to look so that we can review and issue that permit. Now, I know the residents' frustration because they basically are, you know, we're all government, so whether it's the county or the city, the citizens, who there are citizens too because Durham is a countywide agency, they're frustrated that their roads, their neighborhood is torn up, they're looking for some resolutions. So what we need from the city is details on how they want their drainage system to be designed. Submit those to us with the proper engineering certification so that we can review and approve it. So if there's any notion that somehow Durham is going to be doing to the design, that's not correct. We review and issue regulatory permits. The responsibility is on the engineer and the city to build a project that meets the county's requirements, that protects water quality and provides proper drainage. One of the things I recently had an opportunity to come, the city reached out to me directly and said, hey, can we come, you know, can you come down to the city? Let's do a drive through the neighborhood. So with your two assistant city managers, Ms. Torriente and Mr. Carpenter, we drove through the neighborhood, and they were explaining to me the issues that they have with the construction of the road. And here's what I would say. The city has jumped ahead in the process of trying to address sustainability and resilience, and that's laudable. Moving ahead and building a roadway project that is going to be more protective and resilient in the future is a good thing. I think perhaps what should have happened in better detail before they embarked on that roadway project was a decision on how they would deal with the harmonization slopes. Because to have to go back later, after you've already built the road, and deal one by one with property owners on how you're going to deal with harmonization on this property, on that property, on that property, it's really not very good for the citizens, and you're going to end up with perhaps a hodgepodge. So my recommendation was for future projects, make sure you look at the entire design, including harmonization into adjoining properties, so that you don't end up having to come back and rethink something that you didn't, you know, adequately design the first time around. So as far as we're concerned, we're waiting for the city to give us details on what they would like permitted, and quite frankly, we're expecting that sooner rather than later, because at this point we have an open violation. We want the city to come into compliance. The work is done without a permit, and we need that work to be done under a permit, so we're expecting the city to submit the details so that we can review and issue a permit for it.
Thank you very much, Lee. That's very, very, very helpful. Commissioner Higgins, would you like to join and maybe provide a little perspective, a great perspective as representing the county, but also your representative for our residents here?
Yes. Lee and I have reviewed kind of the back and forth on this project, as I, over a year ago, reviewed the back and forth on the Indian Creek project. And so in both cases, we're dealing with the city of Miami Beach not getting proper permits and starting construction. And the end of the day, we end up penalizing our residents when we don't follow the process. Now, we can complain, and I complain directly to Lee all the time. I think DERM is a little slow sometimes, and I wish permitting got faster and was faster. But it's better to be slow at the beginning rather than leaving unfinished construction, in the case of Palm and Hibiscus, probably for maybe an extra 9 months, and in the case of Indian Creek, who the heck knows, several years. To tear something down and pick. So, you know, not to admonish the city of Miami Beach, but get your permits first. In talking with Lee, it certainly seems as if there's actually still some engineering that needs to be done on these things to get the plans up to date. And so I don't know. I think that's kind of a question for the city administration. What is their timeline for responding to DERM? Because DERM has issued kind of very specific what needs to be done, and so I don't yet have a clear timeline on when the city of Miami Beach will be responding to DERM. What I can promise you is when we do get the plans, I will hound DERM to make sure that the county is not, hound Lisa.
I'll hound them. You hound me, I'll hound them.
It'll be a string of us to make sure that is approved quickly, because this is not a new permit. This is essentially destruction of residential neighborhoods that are sort of put on hold with that case. So I'm certainly here to help facilitate that, but right now we don't have the information, and I, despite being a county commissioner, cannot force a regulatory agency to issue a permit when the city of Miami Beach has, to my knowledge, not yet been able to respond to a simple answer. Can an engineer certify that the drains that are installed deal with the first 1-inch stormwater runoff? And if we can't have an engineer certify that, we don't know whether or not those drains are capable of helping us keep the bay clean. So happy to help, want to help, think the situation is terrible for the residents, as is the situation on Indian Creek. So we just need to get this information quickly. I don't know if there's a capacity or an engineering planning resource. And Lee, if they get you all the information, like how quickly can DERM issue those permits?
I can commit my staff's resources to do it. I have the head of my water control section that issues those permits, the head of the Natural Resources Division, her supervisor. We will get those things reviewed extremely quickly within, a week or 2 weeks. Within a week we can have it reviewed.
We would like a week. And one other question that I had thought of, I believe Palm and Hibiscus are on one permit now. Is that correct?
I believe they're presently under one permit, and we're looking to get details because there's been several drains installed, and the plans that have been submitted don't include one of the islands, and it doesn't even provide the disposition on all of the drains. It only shows some of the drains with details on to remain, but others, there's no disposition. So we need to know, are you going to remove those drains, or are you going to move them somewhere else, or do you want to permit them?
Yeah, so I don't know, is there an opportunity to separate those two permits so that the city of Miami Beach could work – separately?
We could
just to resolve. So if Palm is ready to go or Hibiscus is ready to go, we're not holding up any of the other residents for that.
We could certainly do that on our end.
Might be something that could be helpful if the city likes that. So I'm here to help, but right now we just don't have the information to issue those permits.
I believe my colleagues may have a question. Yeah. Commissioner Alamon.
I have a question, and you're Mr. Hefty, you're completely right that the Palm and Hibiscus project was designed and launched without these individual home connections. The result of that, of course, the way that Palm and Hibiscus were originally built, as you know, as the entire city and probably the entire county is built, is that people's personal properties do drain into the public right-of-way, mm-hmm. and that goes into the public system. So that is the built condition, right? Therefore, with the original design of Palm and Hibiscus, just elevating the right-of-way and that being one of the lowest parts of our city, I don't know if it's one of the lowest parts of the county. I don't have that information, but it's certainly one of the Palm and Hibiscus have some of the lowest elevation homes in the city. Homeowners were rightly concerned then if by built condition their stormwater was always going into the public system, and now we elevate the public system, where was it going to go, and what did that mean for their personal property? And so that was why the commission endorsed this residential tie-in. If a homeowner's finished floor was below, not their yard, but their finished floor was below the future Crown of Road, and they could be concerned about interior home flooding, then we would let them tie into the public system, which we had the capacity for, and so forth. And so that was a huge change in the middle of that project, and you alluded to that. And I'm not telling you anything that you don't know. I'm just doing that to sort of establish the foundation of my question, which is that nothing is changing. By way of these 91 connections, nothing is changing for those 91 homes in terms of where the water used to go. Those 91 homes, the stormwater that falls onto their properties used to go into the public system, and it will still go into the public system, but it'll be cleaner because we remove the solids, we spin it, we vacuum out the oils, so we are treating. Is it perfect? It is not perfect. We would like it to be better, and the minute any of us on the city side, on the county side, or anywhere in the world finds the technology that we could deploy, you know, to do that, I think we'll take a hard look at it because we share goals of the health of Biscayne Bay. But my point is, we're not making it worse. We're making it better for those 91 homes. And I'm just concerned about this discussion about the first inch and a half. What do you need to sign off? What do you need from those specs to sign off? Do we need to, if I'm looking at, I'm going to pick on you, Pierre. Is that all right? No. I just mean I'm going to use you as an example. I'm not pick on you, so to speak. But, you know, does a homeowner like Pierre need to hire a landscape architect, design their whole entire yard so they can show you the areas of the depressions in their yard where they're going to collect storm? Like, what do we have to provide to you on a home-by-home basis? I'm a little bit concerned what the requirements are. And is the city clear on what those requirements are and how much of it goes back to the homeowner? Can I get some clarity around that?
Sure. I think from our perspective.
You understand my question, right?
I do. My understanding is that the city is going to be responsible for the entire drainage system, even those drains that are located on private property. And the vehicle, I understand, is the easement agreement that you have with the cities for the harmonization slope. So that the drainage system is really the city's drainage system for the roadway. It's allowing connection for these drains that are next to the road. In some cases, those drains are on city right-of-way. In other cases, they go a little bit further. They go into the private property. So it would be the city's responsibility as part of their drainage project application to the county to show what runoff is going to be going through the system and is the system adequately designed to treat it so that the water quality coming out into Biscayne Bay meets the modern-day requirements. I know you were alluding to the way things were, and like throughout the county. We have many systems throughout the county that are built decades ago that are not the best for water quality treatment. But when you build new things, just like if you or I rebuilt our homes, we would have to build to the new code. When you're building new roads and new drainage systems, they do have to comply with today's standards. So regardless of the fact that it used to run off and go straight into Biscayne Bay, now since you're building new things, they are required to have proper pretreatment and baffles inside so that you minimize the negative impacts to water in the bay.
I understand everything you said. What I'm trying to make sure is that we aren't in the midst of a stalemate, because the ones that suffer in the stalemate are our constituents. Yeah. And so I understand about the easement, and I understand about the city's responsibility for the system. The city cannot force a private homeowner to make other modifications to their personal property to capture and retain the first inch and a half. And I'm trying to understand, is that what you're asking for? Because if that's what you're asking for, I think we need to surface that and figure it out. You see what I'm mm-hmm. – are you with me? So that's what I'd like to understand.
Commissioner, honestly, Madam Vice Chair, the city hasn't even told us what drains you want to keep and what drains you want to get rid of. In the plans that we have, you have the city has not even identified what drains they want to keep and what drains they don't want to keep. So
okay, of the 100 to 200?
Of the 200. There's some that they say on the plans, yeah, we want to keep these, but when we see there's all these other drains that are shown and the disposition isn't accurate on the plans, okay. We're asking some fundamental questions.
Okay.
And so it really seems like the city needs to do its homework to decide what it wants to permit as a drainage system.
Document it.
And the city's design engineer can contemplate the contribution from the private properties going into those yard drains and include that in their calculations.
Okay.
We're not expecting homeowners to do it one by one. Okay. It makes more sense if the city's doing this to benefit their citizens, right. They're including it in their city system, it really should be done by the city.
So just to put a bow tie on that, you're really looking for the locations of the drains, which you stated have not been permitted, and some engineering background to document that they can retain, I think you said, was it the first inch of water?
That was what the commissioner said. That's sort of a typical design standard. When you design drainage systems, you need to be able to do water quality pretreatment.
Right.
And it can be sometimes as simple as flowing through grassy swales or going into catch basins that have baffles in them. In some cases, you use drainage wells so that the first runoff off the streets go down into the ground and not over the outfalls into Biscayne Bay surface water. So there's a number of ways to do that. That's really up to the design engineers. And so as a regulatory agency, we look at an application that's proposed by engineers. So under the code, to submit an application, your engineer is supposed to certify that the project is designed to meet the county's regulations. And that's
okay.
What we're looking for from the
That's very helpful, Mr. Hefty. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Maybe we'll bring the administration up here. Clearly we have some serious issues we're dealing with to hear that we have permitting issues. We've had that before. We are at a stalemate. I think that's where we are. And we've been in a stalemate, and we need to get out of stalemate. So I want to use this session to be as precise as possible of the request of our regulators and how and when we're going to meet it. So, Eric, if you would, please.
Sure. And I will do my best to try to keep this rolling, as I think we've been working very closely with DERM over the past 6 months or so to try to collaborate to make a very difficult situation a little bit better, if not a lot better. And maybe what I'll do to frame the discussion a little bit, could I put up the slides that I think are on, just so that everybody understands what we're talking about. The slide on the left is the 2012 Coconut Lanes, which is really the gist of the challenge that we're facing. The slide on the right is 2019 Coconut Lanes. The slide on the left is at a tidal event of 1.4 NAVD. The slide on the right is 1.88 NAVD. So you're approximately half a foot higher tide on the right-hand side, but yet we're dry. And I would offer, this is another very similar photograph that addresses the same situation. So that's kind of just level set a little bit about what we were dealing with in the past and why the city moved as quickly as it did to try and find solutions to a relatively difficult problem. That's all the slides that I had. As far as the permitting perspective, we did go through the Class 2 permitting process back in 2015 and 2016. We got permits for the entire collection system on both islands. Those collection systems have since been installed, which is part of why you see the difference in the pictures up on the screen. During the process of the project, we realized that we needed to be a little bit more sensitive to our neighbors, to the folks that live out there. And so we took a little bit of a different path when it came to connecting private properties to the public stormwater system, and that resulted in about 108 locations where we potentially could be providing private connections to our public stormwater system. As we've been working through that process of what that looks like, since that doesn't happen many places around the county that I'm aware of, we've been working through that process with DERM to try to find a solution that works for both parties and certainly ultimately serves our residents well. We've gone through the process of submitting the as-built plans on Hibiscus Island, where we had a difference of we actually installed three additional drains within the right-of-way, and we didn't install two of the drains within the right-of-way on Hibiscus. Those as-builts have been submitted back on June 18th. We got comments back from DERM on June 28th. We were able to provide our response on July 8th. Then we got another response on August 7th, and we submitted another response on October 2nd. So we're certainly providing information. We're dialoguing back and forth. We're trying to find solutions. I think we're getting closer. We're not quite there yet, but we do think that we're progressing in the right direction. I would tell you that Palm Island is certainly much more challenging because I think that's where we have about 88 of the 108 properties or connections that we're talking about, particularly on the coconuts. That's where we installed a number of temporary construction drains. As we were going through the process, we realized that raising the roads up could potentially put some of these properties in a little bit different situation during construction activity. So we installed approximately 88 temporary construction drains while we were out there. Those are ultimately going to either get converted to a private property drain, or if we can't resolve the harmonization issue with the private property owner, then we would permit those as a permanent drainage structure. We are ultimately having to go through each of those 108 scenarios as a one-off design condition. Each of those individual properties needs their own drainage calculation to prove that we are retaining the inch and a half of runoff on the property. We're able to accomplish that in some cases because we have some additional capacity in the treatment system that was installed for the right-of-way. In other cases, we're having to modify the inlet elevation so that maybe water stages on the property up to a certain point but then flows into our system before there's any kind of impact to the finished floor elevation of the property. Like I say, a lot of challenges associated with that.
Eric, if I may, because you've hit on a couple important points, and we realize this is a very complex undertaking. One of the requests that I think we heard was the engineering around holding some of the water, whether it's inch and a half. Is that work underway? Are we close to being done with it? Do we have a date when that piece would be done? It seems like a fairly clear request. They want the engineering, to show that we're holding the runoff.
And the discussions that we've had to date are that we should make sure that we close out the existing conveyance system permit process before we submit the permits for the individual private properties. So we're still working through the conveyance system closeout for what's been installed. But, yes, we have 69 of what we believe are ultimately going to be 88 private property harmonization agreements worked out. We've met with approximately 40 of the property owners because these are each one-on-one meetings with the property owners to see, does this work for you? Can you get on board with this program? Because ultimately they have to give us an easement to access the drain within their property to maintain it long term.
Okay.
So we are in the process of going through all 88 of those. 69 are done. 40 meetings approximately have been held with the individual property owners. Once we get the property owners, met with, then we'll be submitting the documentation to the regulatory agency, because if we're not going to install it on private property, we don't need to permit it on private property.
Right. So if I may
finish up on that, sure. And I apologize, I lost my train of thought.
I'm sorry. Yeah, no, it's a technical topic, but it's an important one. So I heard you say that we are in progress on the engineering. It sounds like we understand that requirement. You throw out a number, 69 of 88. The other thing I wanted to follow up specifically on is what I think I'm understanding is there's a question about where the drains are today, where they're being removed and added. That seems like a reasonable sort of request to say, of these 200 drains, what's coming and what's going? Do we have that? And if not, when are we going to have that? It's sort of a master drainage plan of sort.
Sure. So the simple answer is there were 64 swale drains that were installed as part of the original conveyance system permit. The 3 and 2 modification on Hibiscus that I mentioned to you resulted in one difference. One total net difference in drainage structure. That as-built has been submitted to DERM. On Palm Island, there were 17 structures that ultimately were relocated as a result of landscaping challenges that we ran into. We had mature canopy trees, mature palms that were out there, so we moved drainage structures, approximately 17 of those drainage structures, from one location to another in relatively close proximity to accomplish the same outcome. Those as-builts have been submitted to DERM. It's been submitted as a permit modification. It was submitted on August 9th. We received a response on October 7th, and we are in the process of updating our response. We anticipate having that back to them by the 25th.
Colleagues, any questions for Eric, comments?
I'm still listening.
And then there's
yep.
There's the other piece of the puzzle, which is the 88 temporary, what DERM is referring to as edge drains. They're installed within the public right-of-way. They are true. They were not part of the original permit set that was submitted, but ultimately the plan is that they will either be converted into private property drains if we can reach a harmonization agreement, or they will end up being permitted as a permanent structure, and we may make modifications to the structure that's out there to make it permanent. And one other piece of the puzzle, sorry, just to make sure everybody's got all the details. There were 10 properties that requested that they get private property drains at the time of construction. Those 10 private property drains were installed by the private property owners tying into our system, and those permit applications have been submitted to DERM, and we have received responses back. Ultimately, we need to work through the details on those as well, but I know in at least one case, there was a situation where someone had taken some liberties on extending that drain further into their property and potentially into their garage, which obviously we can't have. And that was not done with a city building permit, so our building department went out and made them disconnect that drain. A lot of details, but...
A lot of detail. I mean, the devil's in the details.
It is.
What can we do moving forward? Mm-hmm. Number one, first finishing palm and hibiscus. I mean, that's important, and it should have been done already. But how fast can we get all of the, to answer DERM and get all of the permits in place that are required and get them approved? That's number one. And number two, we're going to be going into all types of residential areas in the future. And what can be done in the beginning if there needs to be harmonization? What can be done with each homeowner to arrange that before the streets are torn up? I mean, I think it was a little backwards.
And I promise you, we've learned that lesson.
Okay.
And so for projects like West Avenue, we're having individual one-on-one meetings with the properties now so that we can design that harmonization.
Right, so the water doesn't go into their garages, right.
Into the initial permit set that goes in rather than an after the fact.
Okay. And the same will be true, that's more multifamily, but the same will be true when you hit the residential areas.
Correct.
There's been a lot of false information out in the neighborhoods saying all kinds of things that are not true. And I there's this feeling that, well, you're going to raise the roads, now the water's going to drain into our houses. It's not true. But we need to get that message out to the public. How, if the roads do have to get raised 12 inches or 16 inches or whatever it is to keep the roads dry in the future, how is that going to tie into each person's home? And that message really has to be made to each homeowner. I don't know how. It's not easy because people have a lot of false information, and I blame most of it on social media. But we have to get the truthful answers to homeowners so that there's a buy-in of the whole system, because it's essential for the future of the city of Miami Beach. And it's very concerning to me, because I think if you read the newspapers and read the meteorological data, we need to get our city higher. Otherwise, there was just recently an article about North Bay Village. It's really important that this is done. And we had a buy-in, and then for various reasons, some of them, now that I'm not in an election, a lot of it is politically motivated, and it's just plain wrong information that's making its way mostly through social media to our residents. And I don't know how you can get a truthful, I think it has to be one-on-one to each homeowner as you're doing on West Avenue.
Thank you for that, Commissioner Malikoff. I do actually, when we're done with this, want to talk about West Avenue, because that's sort of front and center and how we translate some of these learnings into that. But Commissioner Malikoff appropriately talked about the one-on-one. So, Eric, I want to ask you a question. Talk about the role of harmonization agreements in terms of, do we have any in place? Do we require them for DERM? And what happens if we don't get them?
Harmonization agreements are preferred. They're not have-to-haves. And we design our system in the eventuality that we can't come to some sort of agreement on harmonization where we can make it work. And unfortunately, that's the limbo that we're in right now. We're in that in-between stage where we've got the make-it-work scenario out there, but we don't want to sod it and finalize it and walk away from it because we think there's a better solution. And we want to continue to work with the neighbors to reach that better solution. I do appreciate that DERM has been willing to work with us on trying to find a way to make it easier for the residents to work through that process. And I understand there was a conversation between Lee and the city manager yesterday about the harmonization agreements potentially being sufficient for the owner's sign-off on it rather than having to do a formal permit application from each owner. So that's great news, and that's progress, and we love that, and thank you. And so we're going to continue to look for opportunities to do as well as we can with the many different pieces of the puzzle that have to all fit together.
Okay. It's such a difficult situation, and thank you and your team from the county for coming out and, you know, touring and looking at everything. And, you know, when you're there and you realize how many years it's been for the homeowners, you can't help but have compassion and want to be a part of the solution. And I think that we all do. And obviously we're learning. Miami Beach, like Key Largo that we just read about, we can't afford to just wait. We can't afford to just wait until somebody else figures it out perfectly and then copy what they do. You know, so there's bumps and bruises along the way because of the pictures that you see. That was relatively minor before flooding condition, you know, compared to what we've had in the past or what we still have in other parts of our city. So we appreciate your patience, you know, when we stumble, if we don't do everything exactly perfectly. Clearly, none of us, whether it's on the commission side or on the administration side, think it's okay to do work without permits. None of us think that's okay. And we know that we've made that mistake in the past, and we're doing everything we can to not make that mistake anymore. This situation is really tough for the reason that I said. We had a major, major, major design change right in the middle. And we really need to work together. I mean, we really cannot have a stalemate of any kind because people live there, you know. And from the city side, first and foremost, we want our residents to have a good quality of life. That's our top priority. Secondly, this whole program is vital to the future of our city. If we don't continue this work, we won't have a city. And we are a major economic engine, not just for the county, but for the entire state. So it's imperative that we get back up off the floor and get going again. And so, this was a lot of information I heard from, and I don't know how to make sense of it because I think everyone is putting their best foot forward. But I heard that the county doesn't know of the 100 to 200 that they were told in the first place what it actually is. And it sounds like from your side, you don't yet have final agreement with the homeowners on who's gonna come on board with the program. And until you know who's going to come on board with the program, you can't really tell him which ones are going to stay and which ones are going to go. And I appreciate you being patient, too, because what you could do at this point is say, forget it, homeowners. If you didn't sign an agreement yet, then you're out, so that you could have everything nice and tidy. And that's what you said is the reason that you're not doing that is you feel they're going to get an inferior result where they live. And that's not okay with you as a person. And I respect that and I appreciate it. So somehow, I mean, all we can do is encourage everybody to continue to work together. Are there more resources that we can offer, you know, to endorse or fund for you and your team to get them what they need as quickly as possible to complete out the resident meetings? Like, how can we help?
I think that you've done it. We've come to you on several occasions now asking for change orders to the design builder so that they could put additional design resources on this to get the design packages together so that we can sit down with the homeowners, and ultimately that agreement can end up at the regulatory agency so that they can permit it. As we see additional opportunities, we will absolutely bring them to you. But I think at this point, we just got to stay the course. I think we're headed in a good direction. We just got to have a little bit of patience and stay the course.
Yeah. So I want to build on my colleague's comments because, you know, would like to get to sort of some tangible actions. I'm concerned by what I'm hearing. I'm very concerned, and I don't like the course we're on. I think we need to do better. So whether it's additional engineering resources, whether it is some additional actions, we are going to discuss this at commission next Wednesday, and I'd like to hear a little more clarity on the next steps, because I think we're hearing some specific requirements, and I just want to know where we're going to go to meet the engineering requirements, be clear about what the drains are going to be. I mean, if there's a time to sort of reset and say we could use a little more help to jumpstart this, now would be that time. Because right now we're leaving our residents in a lurch, and I'm just not comfortable with where we're at.
And we do have the engineer of record and the design build team here in case you have any questions of them. Certainly to get that ball, you know, rolling as fast as we possibly can, understanding that we don't want to cut any corners on the solutions.
Before Pierre says something, I want to, because he's going to want to weigh in on what I say. Is that all right?
Sure, that's fine.
I mean, at some point, too, I don't know with these individual meetings with the homeowners and the harmonization agreements, I don't know what the status is or how you would describe the ones that have not finished or come on board yet. Some of them may just be a work in process, and we're working through issues and discussion and understanding, and we're making decisions, and they've hired an engineer to look at this or that. That I would describe as like a productive delay. I'm a little bit concerned about an unproductive delay where you have someone that is just not responding or not participating, and does there come a point where you make a call and say, at this point, I'm not going to hold up the rest of the island because somebody's got me, you know, somebody is what's the word I'm looking for? Like
holding off on
stalemate.
Yeah, like stalemate. But with one, you know, with one or two homeowners, and the rest of the island can't, you know, see the project completed. So a question about how that works.
If I may, a few points on the homeowners' perspective. Number one, we really appreciate all the work Eric, your team, has done. And I can see you are working closely with Durham and the CIP. So we appreciate that. But you were asking how can we move forward. And I think in order to move forward, you have to have the homeowners feel confident that the solution offered are the adequate solution. And put yourself in the shoes of homeowners who are not don't have an engineer background, who have some of them been living there for 10, 20, 30 years. You show beautiful pictures of the road, which is very dry, but each time that road is very dry, their property as basically retain waters much more than they used to have. So I think if you want to move forward, there has to be a building of the credibility of the city to the homeowners, so that the homeowners feel secure that whatever solution is offered to them is going to work. Because I think the homeowners are being approached by CIP, representative of Lanzo, usually a representative from a Wade Trim, the design company, and the homeowners are being said, well, that's what we came up with.
Yeah.
You have no idea of what's going to happen. It used to be that the drainage were going to be in front of the properties. Now the drainage has to be inside the properties. So I think that's one of the held up. But to be clear, none of the homeowners are holding it just for the sake of holding. They all want to get it past that stage. They really do. But I think a question is the credibility. So the homeowners are wondering, do we need to hire our own engineering firm to be able to talk on a one-to-one basis with the recommendation from the city and from their team? And that's where it might delay also. So I think that's where the city need to focus. They need to focus on the scientific approach, why this is going to work for each property. Now, obviously, 91 properties on Palm, 18 about on Hibiscus, it takes a lot of work. So is there a way to do it easier, faster presentation? You know, maybe the city should.
Well, I, for one, would be very open to any requests from the administration to break the stalemate and to jumpstart where we're at. Because right now, this is a quagmire. I think we've learned a lot. We're going to have to move on here, but I remain concerned. So my request from the administration is that we take what we've heard today from the residents, we take what we've heard from Durham, an open offer from us to be helpful, whether it's resource, policy. Let's get this thing going, and we'll talk in 1 week at the commission, because I think this needs to go to the full commission, and we need an action plan of what needs to happen so that we can get this thing going, because right now I don't think we're there, but we obviously want to work together. Commissioner Alamon.
Do we have one document, so to speak, where this is shared, a shared deliverable between the city and Durham with everything that's needed, whether it's for the primary conveyance system, whether it's for all the individual connections, whether, like, the project as a whole, all the, okay, good. And okay, so do we agree? Are we in agreement on that list that you are holding of all the different components that have to be permitted on what the status, whose court it's in, basically?
I think we're getting there.
Okay.
I think we're close, but I think we're almost there.
Because if we're operating from one playbook as a team, that's obviously a lot better than any other way, right? We need to have. I think the first thing is to agree on what the outstanding permits are, and if we agree on that, then we ought to be able to easily agree on whose court they're in. And get to work, but be continuously touching base. And from our side, we need, if the ball's in our court, you know, that's our top priority.
And they've been very helpful with us and said, you know, if you can get it to us by such and such a date, we can probably turn it around by such and such a date. And so we've tried very hard to hit those deadlines. I know they've done a good job of hitting their deadlines. We're working through this process. It's a little bit of a slog, but we're working through the process.
Okay. We need to move on. Any closing thoughts, anyone from the county, anyone else? Final thought here as we go. A very quick thought, but
sure. Just you know, you have my commitment at the county.
Yeah.
We issue hundreds of permits throughout the year, so you know, issuing a permit isn't very complicated for us. We're happy to work with the city on solutions. We're happy to meet with the city anytime. From our perspective, we are not at a stalemate. We just simply need the city to complete the details on the plans on what they want permitted and submit it to us so we can process it. It sounds like what you heard today is they're still working through the details on how to design the project property by property. And my recommendation, again, would be in the future, don't start the project until you have those details worked out so you don't end up with, you know, a situation like that where the finish of the project is held up because you're waiting to get modifications to a permit.
Yeah.
That'd be my recommendation.
Thank you, Lee. Yeah. Thank you for joining us. And Bob, did you?
Yeah, and no, and just to answer that, Lee, we won't, you know, we had a big aha moment in the middle of this project that has now landed, so we
and
won't.
If I can go back to what I said at the beginning, please. What the city is doing is innovative. It is true. As a society, we need to figure out how we're going to deal with climate change and sea level rise. And we want the city to succeed because we'd like the lessons that you learn here to be propagated throughout the rest of the county. Durham is a countywide agency. We deal with permitting all over. We'd love to see solutions work so they can be part of our future throughout the county.
Miami Beach has been a leader in it, and you have to learn by doing.
Understood.
Thanks, Lee.
Thank you.
Bob, did you have a quick comment?
I'm Bob Kunst. I'm president of We Love Lakeview. I got to tell you, this is very frustrating. All of my yelling and screaming for the last year and a half is so that we don't have to go what Pierre is going through for 4 years in Lakeview. We don't flood. Why were we put on as the number one project? And then I look at the fact that the city went and got no permits at all for three seawalls. One of the problems is on Lakeview, right on Surprise Lake. We were threatened with having all of our trees taken down, that Surprise Lake was going to be polluted with 128,000 gallons of untreated stormwater. What I think is happening here is the left hand has no clue what the right hand is doing. When we spoke to Durham, We said the city's in violation. What are you going to do about it? Nothing. Would we go to Public Works? There's so many different issues here. I want to thank you, first of all, for sending us this article about North Bay Village and resiliency, because that was really interesting on a host of levels. Because of our screaming not to raise our streets, North Bay Village is taking on the same issue. But North Bay Village also has another statement, which is they can't sell their homes there. Why? Because of all the yelling and screaming on climate change and sea rise. We're facing the same thing here in Miami Beach. Of the 50 top markets, we're number 6 on not being able to sell our homes. So all of this stuff is starting to backfire. Commissioner Simelian, you says 1 to 2 inches every decade. North Bay Village says 2 feet in 40 years. Public Works says 5 feet, 85 inches by the year 2100. Miami Herald is pushing the same stuff. The point is you've scared everybody, not to mention bad media from CBS, from the first debate, Democratic debate here, where they were talking about Miami underwater. All I'm Miami Beach underwater. What I'm trying to suggest is a better coordinated approach. And when we talked to you and brought somebody here from a group from Hinterland, we said they don't have to tear up our streets, they don't have to take down our trees, and I'll be just another minute or two.
No, Bob, sorry, we're tight on time here. We've got to keep
going. I appreciate it.
No.
But this is very important that you understand that you need to talk to us, the homeowners, and not repeat the same mistake. You're working on an old plan. Yep. And no supervision. And I'd like to say to Commissioner Malikoff, thank you for changing your mind. A few months ago when we were here, you said you didn't have to talk to the homeowners. Yeah. We have to have a different approach to the whole thing of what's going on.
Bob,
and I want to work with you guys, but you're not working.
Hang on, Bob. Thank you for your input. We are here to listen to residents. In fact, we're about to just talk about, because Commissioner Malikoff did bring up West Avenue. Eric, I don't know if that would be you or David. I would like to, I attended a meeting with some of the residents at West Avenue, and I would like a quick update on that. I think we may have a resident here who wanted to comment, just in terms of, particularly with the discussion we've had on Palm and Nabiscus, how we're going to sort of be taking some of what has happened there, where we're at in that project as it relates to engagement with the residents, communication. Just a quick update would be helpful.
Absolutely. Good afternoon. David Gomez with the Office of Capital Improvement Projects. The case of West Avenue is by far different than what we've experienced at Palm and Hibiscus. And the reason is that we've been able to make the determination on how we're going to harmonize. We have a policy in place on how we're going to connect private drains. We've begun meeting with each of the individual properties to review those connections. All of this is well in advance of permitting or even completing the drawings. So these discussions have been ongoing for a while. Okay. We've had many community meetings as well as with individual properties. So we are solving the problem before we ever stick a shovel in the ground.
Very good. Anyone from the public? Stefan.
My name is Stefan Genes. I've been a resident for 22 years in Palm View, and I also own a hotel in West Avenue. I do not represent, but I work with WAVNA. I also work with the Lincoln Road Association. First of all, I definitely want to thank everybody at the city, staff, and the commission about, you know, trying to move forward and embrace this what we have to deal with. You know, I'm very proud to be part of this city, and we want to work with you about this. And there's absolutely no question about the fact that we know some things needs to be done. I just kind of like would like to bring a few issues that are more related to West Avenue. One of the big concerns that we do have is that there is currently no agreement for multifamily or commercial building in the books about drainage. So when we're talking about harmonization, you know, we see how complicated it is when we already have an agreement with private residents. But as far as multifamily and commercial, which represent probably 90% of the property in West Avenue, there is no agreement. We had one or two meetings with the regarding harmonization, but the drainage issue was never, ever brought up. My property drains to the street. I'm a commercial property. What is going to happen to me? Most of the properties there, like the density that we're dealing with, you know, some properties don't even have a piece of grass. So the drainage issue that we're talking about needs to be addressed. I'm not saying it's impossible, but we need to have an agreement in place for these commercial and multifamily residential properties. I really agree with, you know, all that's been said about communication. Communication is key there, and I think we lost trust between all the different parties. And I think that one quick suggestion that I would like to bring is that we need to have a standing meeting about this issue. We shouldn't wait till 4 months, 3 months, or whenever it's needed, because the purpose of the meeting is also to build trust, to be able to discuss with each other, not having to go on social media. And I agree there's a lot of bad things that are being said, and they're not accurate, but they're not accurate because there's no opportunity to correct them. If we would have an ongoing meeting, it would completely change the setup. This is really a big, big, big issue. Also, we want to be a team partner. You know, we want to know about all these things. We want to know about, we want to participate in all this issue. We have issue with the generator location. We ask for documents, the feasibility study and things. And just like, we have a completely different sort of problems. And when I heard what's happening with Palmview and Hibiscus, I'm very, very, very concerned.
Are you in touch with your project information officer? Do you know who that person is and have your
contact information? We do talk with Heather, and we do talk with Sabrina. But I felt, you know, like just to let you know, we only had one meeting regarding the dead end of Lincoln Road. And it was on July 2nd with the contractor and the architect. Yeah. One meeting. You know, we're going to be... This is an issue.
No, it actually does.
You're like a great straight man for item 7, so don't go anywhere.
No. Stay with us. We have a couple of things. We've got some folks here. But we are going to talk about it. But one thing I do want to bring up, and maybe this would be a good next step as we think about the next step, we obviously got to get this planning done better up front. We really, really do. We have some good ideas in terms of community engagement. And I think at the last commission meeting, in fact, I'm sure we did, past Commissioner Aleman's program recommending of communications. So maybe one of the things here we need to see is the project charter, the RISE plan. I frankly would like to see a little more pictorial of where are we and when is the construction. I think maybe some of that. So that wouldn't address everything you said, Stefan, but maybe one of the things for our next discussion around West is we could sort of operationalize some of the good communication tools that we just passed. Because I do sense there are questions about, you know, the feasibility analysis of the generator, the harmonization just sort of isn't clear. And we're obviously not going to proceed with any construction till we have that stuff straight this time.
I really think all of this is communication. It just all able to work together. That's the key thing.
Okay. We'll get an update on West Avenue at the next meeting. Stefan, thank you for coming. Mike, we're on a roll here.
Mike Alvarez, yep. Record, a former employee. Number one, I think Palma and Hibiscus, listening to Mr. Carpenter, if they need to do a land survey for each property, that should be starting right now. Let's not wait for the letters from the easements, from the homeowners, but at least that should be going on right now. If it's 88 properties or 100 properties, that's number one. Number two, it would have been nice to hear from the engineer record. It's my understanding from another engineering firm that I know very well, through Lanzo as well, that the engineer record does not want to take responsibility for the yard drains, and he doesn't want to sign and seal. So it would have been nice to hear from the engineer record. And if he's here, come on board. See what he says. Is there a problem between the engineer record and the city? Well, then Mr. Carpenter should be clear with Lanzo, since he's the general contractor, and since this is a design built, it has to go through the general contractor. Number three, and this is my last item, water quality. Mr. Lee Hefty mentioned about water quality. It will be good to hear from Mr. Lee Hefty if he's going to be accepting these yard drains with the best water quality, which right now, minimum standards for DERM is to have injection wells. So maybe Mr. Lee Hefty should come up, if he wants to come up, and address that, because at the end, maybe he gets all this information about yard drains from the city and all that, and then Durham is going to say, well, guess what? The city has to do injection wells for the pump station. I'll leave it at that. Any questions? All right.
Thank you for your input. We have one other project that there are some folks here for, and we wanted to talk about the landscaping on Indian Creek. There was recently a public meeting. We're at sort of a juncture where I think making a decision, colleagues, would move the process forward. So who's going to – maybe someone from the administration could kick us off on Indian Creek landscaping.
Good afternoon. Rodney Knowles, Green Space Management Division of Public Works Department. To help with the seawall project for Indian Creek, Green Space Management decided to, in an effort to restore the landscaping that was removed in order to construct the seawall, engage Craven Thompson and Associates, which are landscape architects, to help devise a plan to help us put in a landscape that is cohesive, because it's 17 blocks, just so that whatever goes in is not only beautiful, but it's also functional. Having said that, we've had several community meetings, engaged the public, gotten some feedback. Craven Thompson and Associates, they've synthesized the feedback and come up with two concepts. Having said that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Scott Peevler of Craven Thompson and Associates, and he'd like to show you an abbreviated version of the presentation.
Afternoon, members. Thank you for having me. I have a quick presentation to go over the two concepts that we prepared. These concepts were based off of the design plans for the seawall and the roadway designs, as well as feedback from our public meeting with the public. This is just a quick overview map showing our project limits. It goes from 41st to 24th Street on the east side of Indian Creek. Concept one, through the design process and reviewing of the design plans, there were three nodes or anchor points that kind of developed itself and along the road, Indian Creek. The first one being at 41st Street, where you have the kind of large bus transit area. The second node being at the pedestrian bridge around 28th Street. And then you have the third node at the south end that kind of overlooks Lake Pancoast. It kind of widens out over there between the seawall and the barrier wall. And these three areas kind of create this three anchor points that can connect the Indian Creek area along the drive and along the Indian Creek. In addition, for this concept, we tried to propose some connectivity for pedestrians. One of the major ones at North End, we have this kind of waterfront promenade where we bring the pedestrians closer to the water, allow some seating areas, and then also have like a specimen kind of iconic tree flanked by some royal palms to create some kind of accented area. That same accented area is being replicated at both the other nodes to create this connectivity down the road. At the pedestrian bridge at 28th, this is where the pedestrian kind of comes over from the neighborhoods. From there, we go south with a meandering kind of path along between the barrier wall and the seawall through the landscaping, and then gets to Lake Pancoast, where we've created another third node and interest point that allows views out to Lake Pancoast, and it's also where the city's project with the mangrove planter is going. Possible area for educational signage when it relates to mangroves and how they work and function within the waterways. And regarding the landscaping in between the nodes and the connectivity, we're proposing varied layers of landscape to kind of help buffer the barrier walls, help screen some views, open up some views, and then also at the terminal roads that intersect Indian Creek, we're providing some larger shade trees to kind of help block some of the light pollution that does kind of go across Indian Creek into the residents. This is just a three typical sections. Actually, I can go back. I wanted to make a point. North of the pedestrian bridge on 28th, talking about connectivity, it narrows as you go north towards 41st. So between 28th or 29th and 39th, the distance between the seawall and the barrier wall starts to constrict, and it doesn't allow a lot of room for both a walkway or landscape. So the route we ended up taking was we proposed landscape instead of the walkway to kind of help provide some screening or buffer of that barrier wall and to kind of soften the aesthetics along Indian Creek. There's also utilities in there, storm structures. That's part of the roadway drainage portion that is in there as well. So with that, these are the typical sections that you can see that towards the north end at 39th is the narrowest. You have about 3.5 feet to 4 feet between the seawall and the barrier wall. And right at the end of 39th, is actually there's 0 feet. They're almost right next to each other where it kind of pinches down. As you go farther south of that, it starts to widen up where you allow some usage of larger plant material, layer plant material. And then once you get past the pedestrian bridge, it opens up to where you allow to have a pedestrian walk and the additional landscaping to help kind of soften that area. Concept two is basically, while we had our public meetings, some people wanted the path, other portions at that time did not want to pass. So concept two is taking that into consideration, is actually only having pedestrians kind of at the bus stops on node one, and then you had the pedestrian bridge at node two that tie into proposed bus stops, but all the other paths have been removed, and it's just a lush, layered landscape with shade trees, intermediate trees, and some palm trees that accent. On both concepts, we have tried to open up some views for the buildings on the east side of the road to allow views to the water. So it's kind of a balancing act between the two to try to help buffer but also have some views. So that's the end of my presentation. I'd be happy to take any questions.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
On the areas where there's not much space for landscaping, is there room for adding more mangroves on the west side of the wall?
The barrier wall or the seawall?
The seawall.
Not really. Mangroves require a very kind of a shallow area of water. The depth there is over 11 feet. And to be able to plant a mangrove next to the seawall, you would have to build it up, and that encroaches into the canal area that is run by the Army Corps.
Okay. Thank you.
Comments from the public? Alicia?
Can you ask them for an update from the public meeting?
Hi, Alicia Casanova.
Sure, I will.
Mid Beach Neighborhood Association. So I attended your meeting, and so just a few minor comments. Number one, we all heard the controversy between the Flamingo owners and the Indian Creek owners with regard to the barrier wall that's going to be painted with Art Deco colors. So we don't have a position on that, but we advocate for our members, and I understand totally why they don't want a concrete barrier to be in between the water and their views. So, and if you are going to paint it, please let's not get too tacky with all those million colors. Let's simplify that. We saw some drawings there that were very, very busy. Secondly, we regret that it's so narrow that the pathway can't continue, but we strongly advocate for a pathway. These property owners deeded that land in exchange for a pathway, a walkway. Satisfying the needs of a few Flamingo owners is not the right way to do this. A pathway, even though it's cut short and it's going 29th south, regretfully, but at least it's something where people can walk by the water. And thirdly, you presented this cracked stone. What is it called? The cracked shells?
Crushed coquina.
Huh?
Crushed coquina.
Crushed coquina. No. That is not. That's going to be high maintenance. That's going to be uncomfortable for walking. It's going to spread that sand and that shells all over the street, make a mess. We suggest and hope that this can be considered to match the same pavers that are on the beach walk. So if you have an aerial, you can choose to walk on the pavers that are on the east side on the beach walk versus through Indian Creek and make it a meandering paver-like beach walk with the same kind of brick that is being now installed on phase three of the beach walk. So basically, we, of course, vote for concept number one.
Okay. Thank you, Alicia. Just a comment. Anna Marie?
Good afternoon, Anna Marie Mello, MBNA. Just to echo what Alicia was saying, so with the walkway, she did mention how we prefer to have a continuous walkway. If we create those nodes, that was something in one of the first meetings we had with the design team, we expressed a concern that those nodes would really be a refuge for those that might be struggling right now with experiencing homelessness or looking for a refuge to either elicit illegal behaviors or other unwanted activity along the path by breaking up nodes. We do want it to be continuous. I understand there's not enough to have the landscaping barrier as well as the walking path. And I was not at the public meeting this week, but based on Alicia's presentation to our board, it was deemed that it was not wide enough for both.
Correct.
But how do we create that continual path? Because if we don't, folks are not going to, when you're a block away from the beach, you're not going to go necessarily, we're not going to have that foot traffic that would help with that kind of increasing the walkability across the Indian Creek when you have the beach less than a block away where the beach walk, especially if you do it with the shells. Yeah. Probably is not going
to
be there.
That was just a general approach. I mean, we're obviously welcome to looking at other options for the paving material, and we'll go, you know, talk with the city on, you know, long-term maintenance stuff, what they prefer.
And was the city open to having both the landscaping and the walking path, and is that something that we could, is there a third concept that actually connects the walking path all the way across?
There is no third concept. We anticipated having both the landscaping and the pathway as far as we could possibly take it. Whenever there was a conflict between not having enough space for the pathway and vegetation, we opted for vegetation instead, but to try to, wherever there was a pathway, make that experience as memorable as possible. The good thing is that because we're still early on and this is just a concept, I think a lot of the species and materials are still up in the air and we can still massage that. We're just trying to, I guess, come to the decision whether it's going to be a landscape and a path solution or just a landscape solution. And based on most of the feedback we've been receiving, it's a path and landscape solution, and we'll take that path as far as we possibly could.
Okay. So there are a couple of nodes, just so the committee's aware, that seem to be quite small, and those nodes are not going to, I don't think they're going to get to the intent of what the walking path is.
Unfortunately, we can't, you know, get connected all, completely north to south because of the existing utilities, access for utilities that are required that are in that area, and the narrowing where it ends up being 3 feet, where you would either have a 3-foot path maybe or landscape. Mm-hmm. But then your path is disconnected as well because you might have some areas that you can put a path, mm-hmm. but then it goes nowhere. You can't get to a bus stop. Unfortunately,
yeah.
So we felt that trying to get to a point where it's localized, cross at a bus crosswalk to the east, and then connect that way. We tried. We tried to get as far north as possible.
So just from lessons learned from the beach walk and having the confused palm trees that are 7 feet off of the edge and can create some confusion, if we could, we just would welcome a site visit and be able to walk that through with the members and with those with the hotel managers and owners and the condo owners that live along that strip, just to be able to better conceptualize it. Because in drawings, it's really hard for us that aren't designers, landscapes, or in urban designing fields to really be able to conceptualize that. The last one was that the bike lane, as much as we wanted that to be raised and separated from the street, but didn't happen. And since it will be on the road, having it buffered, we heard that you mentioned having the poles. Just thinking of something more creative or some way to really be able to separate that bike lane from the road. Please keep in mind this community has had a great burden with this street project. We recommended to commission through the transportation committees in July for both lanes to be open, especially during the high season of Art Basel and the Super Bowl. And it looked like this committee chose not to go forth with that recommendation in July because the construction was going to open up for the second lane in October, which it's October 23rd, and I haven't seen that start yet. And so that's already a burden, the congestion and all of the other negative impacts. Economically, a gentleman was mentioning earlier how homes aren't selling. It's really hard to sell when you have that kind of construction year in and year out. We know the addition advocated for more than 2 years to get that project going, and they just kind of dropped off from advocating after years. I mean, this has just been a huge burden to us. So if we can make this walkway or if we can make this landscaping project just right, as well as considering what the impacts of the transportation project will be over the next 3 years during these high periods for our hotel members and our condo members, we'd greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne-Marie. If there are no other comments, colleagues, any questions at this point? I think what the I caught you right
eating
there.
Eating my lunch. I'm multitasking, eating my lunch.
I saw you biting. I figured I'd ask right at that second.
So sounds like from your public meeting, the weight was on the side of including the pathway.
Correct.
How many blocks long is that pathway?
Do you have an idea how many?
From 41st to 25th.
Path?
Oh, path? Yeah, from there's the promenade kind of portion at 41st through 39th, and then you have the pedestrian bridge with 28th to 25th.
Okay. Was that in your diagram? Can I just see that?
Yeah. Where are we at? Concept 2. Concept 1. All right, so on the bottom viewport, the pedestrian bridge is kind of, you see where cut crosses.
I see where the pedestrian bridge is. Mm-hmm. There you go.
That's not going to work on the
TV. It doesn't work on the screen.
So pedestrian bridge right there, mm-hmm. So that's where the path starts, and then it goes south all the way around towards...
To the mangrove planter.
Yeah, to the mangrove planter, and then it connects to the existing sidewalk that's on the roadway there now. Which actually comes in front of the barrier wall at that point.
And is there a crosswalk there at the pedestrian bridge?
Yes, if you go north to the next block, that's 29th, that's the crosswalk. There's a bus stop there as well.
Okay.
If I may, is there any opportunity to adjust the location of the crosswalks to get more pedestrian space?
I would have to get with transportation, with Josiel about that.
It looks like the leaning was towards option one. We definitely want some pedestrian walkway. My own view, and I think my colleagues, which I would want as much as possible, so if there's a way of adjusting the crosswalk or anything we could do to maximize the pedestrian experience, I would just like to add that.
Great. So do you need a motion for
that? Yeah,
move support of option one, which is includes the pedestrian
option path. One with as much pedestrian space as possible. I think the bike lane, and however best done, probably really would benefit from some protection. There's such traffic there, and I'm not, I don't have a preference on what the solution is. I used bollards as an example, but if there's a better, more creative solution, I do think we need some landscaping. I think the idea of a walkthrough with the public when we're ready to just sort of bring this to life makes sense. And I'm just going to add one other thought in a very friendly manner here. There were some residents there who were on the east side of the street that had some landscaping that clearly has changed. I would just like us to take a look. If there's documented evidence that folks had landscaping and now they don't, I think we should at least explore what we can do to put back something that was there. Right now, we've left them in a much different situation.
Absolutely. The palette of vegetation, has it been selected already?
We have a good idea where we want to go with that. It's going to be... 95% native.
Mostly native material, but then also non-native to provide some color.
Right. But it's mostly going to be a native palette, something that's going to be able to withstand some saltwater spray and inundation. Just something that's going to look good long-term, and it's going to be easy to maintain.
Okay. I agree with the color, but you can find natives that bring vibrant color. I would try to stay in the Florida-friendly as much as... completely. Right?
We'll do.
And so we'll move this, as stated, to the full commission so we can get this piece of it going.
Thank you.
Okay.
By acclamation. Great. I want to move to item number 11. We have a few folks here. We've got a busy agenda, so we'll try and work through it pretty quickly. But I'll tee this up. It was my item. The grand jury published a report about the health of Biscayne Bay. There's quite a bit of discussion. The county has a task force on Biscayne Bay. One of the items that particularly called out was some activity that the city of Aventura has been doing, particularly with screens as it relates to storm drain gratings. So that is one particular thing. So I'd welcome the administration's comments on the report itself, but most importantly, to discuss the Aventura experience and whether there's an opportunity potentially, Roy, to pilot something like this. I know we looked at it in the past.
We had a pilot in the past, but unfortunately it didn't work because the drains got filled with mud and leaves and the water backed up and flooded the streets.
Mm-hmm. Chairman Samuel and members of the committee, Roy Coley, Director of Public Works. Yes, we did have a pilot project a couple of years back. We have a short presentation, I think, that's available that shows you our pilot project, where we installed a couple of different name brands of inlet grates on Ocean Drive. We installed those grates, and what we experienced was when we would get these sudden afternoon thunderstorms, the wind would blow suddenly, and the leaves and the debris out of the park would hit the street, clog up the drains. The sudden rains would then cause flooding conditions in the sidewalk cafes, and then they would call. At first, our suppliers of the product thought maybe they could stand to be readjusted and installed differently, and it might reduce that. So one of the suppliers did offer us technical assistance, came here, and made sure that they were installed in the most advantageous way. The complaints continued from our sidewalk cafe folks, and so we ultimately removed them because all of these drains were tied to pollution control structures the city had installed that had bar screens for grading and also sedimentation boxes and vortexes for removing the sediments. So we believed we were capturing more centrally without the grates, and we eliminated the complaints from our sidewalk cafes. We did have some pictures of this. I don't know if they're ready to go up.
So, you said there were some challenges on Ocean Drive, and I recall hearing that as well. I think we had it in a couple locations. Did it fare better on? I think it was Meridian, perhaps.
There was one installed in Meridian prior to this that wasn't part of this pilot that we did. It didn't have the same challenges that Ocean Drive had. Obviously, the location at Meridian, we didn't have the sidewalk cafe issue and didn't have quite the same elevation challenge. So it wasn't the same condition. Ocean Drive just was extremely challenging for this.
Can I just ask, what is what is the problem that we're trying to solve? I guess if the hard debris, water bottles and plastic bags and so forth, if they are coming into our system, which includes the catch screens, the vortex, all of that, where we're, and I don't know, we clean those out regularly to take all of the solid debris out of the stormwater system before it goes out to the bay. What is the problem we're trying to solve with this item?
I think the problem that we'd be trying to solve is, one, to minimize anything getting into the system which could make its way through our system, and second, to reduce any cost by preventing it at the front of the system, and third, maybe to reduce nutrients that could be getting in the system
But, I mean, I guess, are people concerned, and is it happening, that solid debris, in spite of the fact that we have a catch screen and the vortex system, that solid debris is still making its way through that in material quantities?
Let's hear from our chair of the sustainability.
Do we have any data on that?
Hi, Dave Dobler, chair of the sustainability committee. I actually presented to the grand jury, and this has been something I've been working on. I'm not an engineer, but I've learned a tremendous amount about the storm drain systems. So there's a couple of problems that these gratings, these stormwater filters, can solve. The first is the nutrient load within the stormwater system that actually exits the bay. And we're talking about leaves and regular material debris that will decompose. Once it starts decomposing, it releases nitrogen and phosphorus, which are required for us to mitigate in various ways through our pollution discharge permits. So by preventing debris from going in, we actually will reduce the nutrient load going into the bay. While even though it might be captured within the catch basins, that material is still rotting. It's still decomposing, and then when it rains, that flushes out.
Okay, so you're concerned about the time period that organic matter is in the system before it gets to our filtration system.
That it's actually sitting in the filtration system. Mm-hmm. So DEP has released a report and a calculator showing that catching this debris at the street level is 5 times less expensive than cleaning it out and trying to capture it within the stormwater system and cleaning it out. So we are spending a tremendous amount of money on the maintenance of our stormwater systems because we're allowing debris and trash to go straight into the systems, where we then need a truck with couple people to go vacuum it out. And Roy and team are doing a fantastic job of increasing the cleaning of the stormwater frequency. But by keeping it out of the stormwater system in the first place, the city would be saving a tremendous amount of money. The additional problem that we're trying to solve is that the pollution controls are very effective at capturing large debris, like a water bottle or a soda bottle. But as the trash gets smaller and smaller and smaller, it becomes more difficult for the pollution control systems to actually capture it. So things like cigarette butts, bottle caps, straws, and pliable products like plastic bags or cigarette wrappers are more difficult to capture, which require a much more expensive pollution control system in line. And so if we can keep it out of the system in the first place, and that's what we were working on with Commissioner Malikoff about trash can on every corner, it is cheapest and easiest to keep it out of the systems in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I also have some feedback on the pilot program because I pushed very hard for that pilot program.
Please.
I agree that maybe these aren't the most appropriate in every location. But as we're designing new locations such as West Avenue, where we actually integrate these into the design, these would probably be much more effective. I'm very concerned about the amount of grime and grit and dirt and mud that was created on Ocean Drive that was clogging a couple of these units up. It seems like if we're cleaning these, our streets and our sidewalks daily, two things. One is, why is there so much mud and muck on Ocean Drive in the first place? It tells me we have a really dirty street where our tourists come. And the second thing is, we have an opportunity to involve sanitation in this process because they can clean at the street level, whereas Public Works put the gratings in, and there was I don't know that there was any ask of the pressure washers, hey, give it a quick spritz every once in a while. But yeah. The one on Meridian Avenue performed flawlessly for well over a year as it was implemented.
And Dave, can you say a word from your experience what happened in Aventura? I don't know if you had any insight.
I had nothing to do with Aventura.
Nothing to do with that one. Fair enough.
But I know that they were piloted in Key West and Aventura, and they're also being various versions are being deployed out in City of Miami. Even a version that's different than the Ecotech. The EcoSense is being deployed right now in City of Miami, and that has no reason to clog up because it's not really trying to catch the small stuff.
I put this on the agenda with the following thought, actually a fairly simple request. Maybe based on the fact that at least one vendor approached me and said they'd do it at no cost to the city, which is usually a good price, that in the interest of enhancing water quality, all the focus of the grand jury, at least to ask the administration to have a conversation, to have a discussion around whether, given it's been a couple of years, whether it's worth having a pilot, and come back to us with a recommendation. So I think it's at least worth exploring.
So you're just asking the administration to meet with the vendor
who's
proposing a free pilot and come back and recommend
and
whether they agree or not.
That's the ask.
Commissioner, we're always willing to do that. I did want to mention, since yep. Since Dave brought up sanitation, our sanitation team is doing a phenomenal job on Ocean Drive. We agree 100% the real way to prevent pollution in the bay is prevent it from hitting the ground, and we are emptying trash cans daily. We're cleaning the street daily. We have nothing short of an army on Ocean Drive every morning from one end to the other cleaning that so it never enters the system. We believe that is the cheapest way after, of course, we've done a sufficient public outreach campaign trying to educate the public that anything they throw down or hits the ground winds up in the bay, and we think that's step one. And we do agree with Dave 100%, prevention is the best cure.
Absolutely. It's a multifaceted approach. Our pumps play the role. You're exactly right, Roy, in terms of preventing it at the source. This is something some other folks have some experience with. Let's have that conversation. Let's talk about whether there are any locations, whether indeed there's an offer that makes sense for the city. If it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. But I'd at least like us to pressure test that and come back next time.
I would say two things. One is we still may have the units from the original pilot program. Do we know if we still have the units? Somewhere in the warehouse?
I have no idea.
Talking about a different...
Yeah, no, I'd like to get the latest and greatest, and I'd like to see if indeed we could do this at, you know, no cost to the city.
The second
for
thing
our
is,
test.
The second thing is that, you know, I was walking to go get an acai pull on 8th, and I had my my bucket and my picker, and I picked up three bucketfuls of trash along the way that was... I mean, it was just everywhere. And I just see, when I look into the storm drain systems, I can just see all of the trash that's on there. You go by Washington on 13th, right in front of Crunch, and, I mean, there's always so much trash just sitting in those storm drain
everywhere.
Systems.
It's everywhere. This is not just a South Beach problem. I live in Mid Beach, and every morning I walk the dog, and within one block I can almost fill up a Publix or other such grocery store, let me not promote them, you know, a garbage bag
full of
litter, you know, in my single-family home neighborhood. So it's not just an entertainment district problem. It's a human behavior problem.
Okay. We'll revisit on next one. Now, we're at 2:45. There's two items. Roy being there reminded me we want to talk about water and sewer, but we had some folks from UM, maybe not till 3.
Yes, they should be here by 3 o'clock, and okay. I believe Commissioner Areola will be coming down for that item.
Oh, perfect. So,
can we do 7? Because I do have to pick up my son.
Yes,
I know we extended the time frame,
no,
but I can't
No
stay
worries. That's fine. So we'll jump to item 7, and then we'll do the water and sewer report right after.
Perfect. And for our West Avenue friends who are still here, this is the
item
we were alluding to. And I'll just cue it up while the staff is coming up. What I asked for, so... who knew? when I got into office in 2015, I had no idea that here was the city launching on this, you know, multi-hundreds of million dollar program with $0 allocated to communicate with the public and inform and educate and bring us all along together from an information standpoint. So we closed that gap. We funded or provided some funding to communicate with the public. And one of the things that I asked for, because I have a long career in complex project management. And so I asked the administration to think about what is the standard work plan for one of these projects like what West Avenue is going through, from planning to design to construction to post-implementation. What is that? What are the standard activities? At what point during each of those phases is it appropriate to engage the public? What would we know to tell them at that point, and what criteria can they influence at each stage? So they've been working on that, and that leads us to item 7, which was to figure out how to, because one of the things I think our residents want to know is when am I going to know anything? You mentioned having regularly scheduled meetings. My ask was, if we can explain to the public what is this standard work plan and at what points are they going to be engaged, then, you know, then they can relax. Okay, these are the things I need to pay attention to, and I can participate then and make sure that I have input. Every neighborhood is unique, and the folks that live in each neighborhood want to be a part of making sure that their neighborhood doesn't lose its unique identity, and that's part of the role that they play. So that was the ask, and I know the administration's been working mm-hmm. on that.
Thank you. Exactly everything she said. So we did work with Commissioner Aleman, and a lot of the PIOs got together. And I'll also preface with everything that we're working on with this, once finalized, will also be incorporated with the external communications plan that you guys approved at the last commission meeting. So that will take that communications plan one step further and further define all of the engagement at each toll gate, as you said. So after we met with Commissioner Aleman and talked about the various areas where we would reach out to the public, and we talked through, okay, so in this area, what does it make sense to discuss with the public, and what sort of feedback can they give back? So what you have here is kind of our first draft, our first stab at doing that. So the first, the colorful blocks that you're going to see is kind of my attempt to take the process and say, okay, this is kind of the flow chart of how the process works. And all of these red boxes would be opportunities for engagement with the community. And then as you look further, after we met with Commissioner Aleman, we took those engagement opportunities and said, okay, at each of those toll gates, what would we be discussing with the public? And so you'll see engagement defined a budget process, engagement defined a planning process, engagement defined at the design phase, engagement defined at pre-construction, and engagement defined during construction, where we went through each of those steps and tried to say, okay, at this phase, this is what we're going to discuss with the public. So we filled in based on the feedback with the PIOs and what residents tend to expect and what is feasible at each toll gate to discuss. And then, once we move past that toll gate, all of these things really should be finalized and approved, and then moving on to the next toll gate. And so do you have any questions or thoughts based on the drafts that we have right here?
Commissioner Malikoff, anything? I'll weigh in then. I think this is excellent. I really like where we're going with this. I just have a couple thoughts because you mentioned sort of first draft. We're trying to iterate a little bit. I think it would be helpful, and maybe this will come when the communication play comes into play, to sort of call out the deliverables a little bit. What comes at each phase, okay. I think would be helpful. Mm-hmm. I think we should have something on like an after action. So the project's done, where we talk about measurement, a case study, for example. I think in whether it's a dotted line or some graphic to highlight ongoing communication. I can't tell you how often I get that email and say, where are we with Indian Creek? And what's the next step on West Avenue? So I think we could highlight that. My last request is the same I made for the communications. This is excellent work, great methodology. I'm so excited to see it, and I'm so excited to now bring it over to the projects, whether it's Palm Hibiscus, West Avenue, Indian Creek, so to operationalize it, because I think the tools are very helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner. So just a couple things based on what you said. The Ready team has discussed this as well, and the after action that you talked about is something that utilizing the engagement toolbox, external communications plan, I'm confusing my engagement tools, and the information that CIP has or whoever's doing the project that, at that point, that would then lead to an after action that Ready Team would review, and that would also be posted on the website on the project page along with everything else as described in the RISE guide.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, obviously right now this looks very technical, right? No, it's a little hard to digest at this stage, but it's just because it's still being formed. But for example, just to provide some color to it, looking at the planning phase of the project, the teams, and there's a few of the PIOs in the back, the way that this was constructed was really through interviewing them and having them reflect on the projects that they have already been managing. What decisions are made during each stage, and what influence can residents have?
Sure.
On what's being decided at that point. So, for example, at the planning phase, we're talking about having residents weigh in on undergrounding, on street parking, on utility relocations, blue and green infrastructure, landscaping, street ends, just to give some idea. At the design phase, it's, you know, another level of detail. Actual plant selection, where before we might be looking at, you know, landscaping in a general way, by the time you get to design, you're actually selecting species and those kinds of things. So it takes you to ever increasing levels of detail, I would say. So ultimately, what I hope we'll get to is a deliverable that describes that communication and input process in a resident-friendly way, mm-hmm. that, you know, that we can distribute to residents at, you know,
yes.
even before a project starts.
Yes. So what we were kind of hoping for is the feedback that we have kind of bulleted at each level. We just kind of wanted a little bit of feedback from you to see if you had any thoughts or if you, you know, thought things should be better defined. Or we do say engagement defined during construction. Once construction starts, it says that there will be regular communications with the public. We didn't state if it was monthly or weekly or biweekly because it really kind of depends on the work going on in the project. If there's one of the things that we have started with the PIOs is if there isn't an update, there's no reason to give an update. So there's no reason to send an email about a project that doesn't necessarily have an update to just give an update.
I would encourage you as much as possible to use graphics mm-hmm. and color because people seem to have very short attention spans as far as reading a lot. But if they can see a pictorial yep. view of where a project stands, I think it goes a long way.
Yes, we have asked them to incorporate a lot more imagery in the updates that they've been doing. And since around January, we have moved all of the PIOs and standardized all of their updates and invitations to the Rising Above brand and to make sure that they're also kind of standardizing how they're saying it. So they're not looking at, they're making sure that, you know, they're using appropriate language in there and saying things a little bit more understandably and not speaking in technical talk to our residents to make sure that they better understand the project that is going on, as well as using imagery in the notices and updates to make sure that it's better understood by everybody.
Mm-hmm. And I still hope ultimately that deliverable, that one pager that residents can look at, show a work plan, show the standard work plan, planning, design, you know, a Gantt, a high level Gantt chart with all the little toll gates of when residents get to have input. So that they can see, it's a promise, right? It's a promise. You're going to be proactively engaged by the city every step of the way until it's done. I know that that is what you do. It's putting that on paper so that a resident can see that promise.
If I may add, I think one important thing that needs to be said out loud is that we probably need to do a better job when we're holding a meeting to say the purpose of the meeting. Sometimes we come to a meeting to listen and learn. Other times we come to a meeting to engage and get feedback. And early enough in design to make kind of like a community decision to influence. Sometimes when the commission votes and the budget is set, then we're just coming back for regular updates, not necessarily to change the plan because that becomes a change order and delay. And so I think moving forward, now with more strategic communications and more alignment with central communications and outside PIOs in projects, I think we will do a better job of just sort of standardizing the message and also really the purpose of the meeting. I do want to also mention that what we're learning here is we've also put it in Resilient 305. This is something that other cities, are going to learn from us. And, in fact, we're hosting our first Resilient 305 Lunch and Learn, and Tanya and I are going to be kind of doing an update and really in a working session on the RISE Guide and talking about, you know, how to better communicate throughout all different projects and all PIOs across Miami-Dade County, as well as our PIOs are being invited to that event on November 15th.
Right. And remember, this whole item also came out of trying to prevent scope creep and prevent revisiting decisions that had already been made and were supposed to be in the rearview mirror. And if you look on page, you know, 106, we were talking about, well, what are some of the challenges to that? And some of the challenges are, first of all, that the stakeholders can change, whether it's city staff, the property owners, or neighborhood leadership. People can be late to the game, so to speak. We can't let that cause us, you know, just because I'm new and I wasn't here for design, and now we're in construction, that doesn't mean that just because I'm new, I get to throw the whole city and its project and all the neighbors back into design. And that has absolutely been happening. So the purpose is to be clear about what the toll gates are and what decisions are made at that time and not revisit them. We have to move forward, because the reason I say that is that is what's going to drive extended project durations, budget overruns, and other things that we can't afford. You know, we want to leave the neighborhoods, as we come in with a neighborhood improvement, the whole in the name it says it, right? The neighborhood's going to get better. It's going to be a construction project, and that's going to be unpleasant, but at the end of the project, the neighborhood is going to be improved, and it's going to be better. That doesn't mean that the neighbors get a blank check to pick whatever lighting, whatever trees, and change their mind 10 times. The city doesn't have a big enough bank account to write blank checks to every neighborhood. So that's why we need discipline around these different toll gates and the decisions that are made.
Right. I think it's very good work, and let's continue to proceed here. And we're going to move on, if that's okay, to the water and sewer item. We've got a hefty topic there. The very quick version, please.
Yeah, just one quick thing. I think this is great. My biggest concern is that, like, I'm just amazed about how some resident business owner or whatever are not informed at all. I don't know where they hibernate or whatever. And it just, like, you know, the thing is, like, how do you engage them as early as possible so that, like, I'm spending half of my time re-explaining where we at, what has been decided and thing, and they're just like, well, I didn't know. And like, what communication, what tools do you have in order to make sure that everybody's informed? Because otherwise you're going to get just the vocals and the extremes. And I think that, like, if you want to get it's super important to get that database of people and making sure everybody's is involved.
Would you like me? So as a project begins, the project information officer goes around to the neighborhood, and generally we'll do a door-to-door and gather all of the email addresses and mailing addresses. And whenever they're going to have a meeting and whenever they have information to send out, they send it to that email group. So they send it to everybody, and then we also post everything on the website. So everything is out there digitally, and if it is a major meeting, they will go door-to-door to make sure and do a mailing to make sure. So that's based on the information that they get when they go door-to-door for the contact information for everybody. That's where they send the information to.
But, I mean, of course, you know it, and you're feeling it. You can lead a horse to water, right? But you can't make them drink. So there's a little bit of that. Thanks for coming.
Very good. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Nelson Perez-Jacome, City Engineer. We're here to present today on the city's water and sewer master plan. Over the course of the last year, our consultant, Hazen and Sawyer, has worked with city staff to not only develop the models, but calibrate them and identify capacity, fire flow, and renewal needs in the order of $283 million over the next 20 years. So,
in order to get you guys back on schedule, I'll just let the ladies who actually did all the work.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Jason, just to be very brief, I just want to mention that this was a very detailed process, so we'll just be, you know, giving a very, very brief overview as we go. I'll just briefly walk through the water master for the master plan development methodology, which was used for both water and sewer master plans. So there were three major components, the first one being the hydraulic model, which we built for both water and sewer, which was used to then come up with the capacity of the system and see where capacity improvement needs were. We also looked at evaluating the above-ground assets where physical condition assessment was done and projects were identified. And then the third being evaluation of underground assets, which is your buried pipes, and how we prioritize them based on risk. So I'm going to skip through some of the background slides and go directly into the water master plan. So as I mentioned, this is just a brief overview of city's water system. City's a wholesale customer of Miami-Dade WASDE right now with four interconnects and one emergency interconnect on the north at Byron Avenue. In terms of some of the key infrastructure, the city includes four water booster pump stations, which basically pump the water coming from WASDE at a higher pressure and the pressure that's needed in the city, along with two locations where water storage tanks are, The combined capacity of these water storage tanks is about 14 million gallons, and there are booster pump stations at each of those storage tanks as well. This is just a brief overview of what the distribution system network looks like based on pipe age, material, and diameter. And as you can see, there is quite a bit of pipe, which is cast iron and DIP. And in terms of pipe age, we have quite a bit of pipe, which is older than 50 years.
And what's the normal useful life?
So the normal useful life is based on the pipe material as well as the diameter. In this case, mostly it is DIP and CIP, so based on some of the adjustments, it's roughly about 50 to 60 years. Mm-hmm. With some materials, they can be even longer.
It'd be interesting to see an overlay of those two pie charts in perspective of like a useful life coloration, like how much do we have left, right? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, so we do actually cover that in the later part of the presentation, and that's how we determine which projects to prioritize.
Thank you.
So this is just an overview of the model that was used. In terms of the evaluation, we looked at making sure that there was adequate pressure in the system, there's adequate fire flows for the planning period through 2045, and like what if scenarios, what if, you know, one of the WASDE interconnects is off, do we have adequate capacity? I'm just going to skip through some of the things. For above-ground assets, as I mentioned, there was a study that was done wherein physical condition assessment of those assets was conducted, and several assets that were critical were identified, and some of the critical rehabilitation projects were identified as part of this evaluation. The third part, which you were just mentioning about, was about the useful life of the pipes. And this basically goes, that is a factor that was taken into consideration for the underground assets. So there were two major components that were considered in this, which is consequence of failure and probability of failure. How likely is that pipe to fail? And is that a major pipe? Like if it's just a small residential pipe, it may not impact as many customers, whereas like a big trunk would create a lot of issues for the city. So we came up with a matrix in identifying how we will rate which projects are more critical or which pipes are more critical to be replaced based on how much flow is going through the pipe, based on land use, and based on proximity to major roads. So, and we identified consequence of failure scores based on that matrix. Here basically is a summary of those items. So on the top table there, you can see on the left side, it's the consequence of failure. And on the right, there's the probability of failure. So anything which has a high probability of failure and high consequence of failure would be replaced first, followed by something that has a relatively lower consequence of failure but a high probability of failure next. And we basically move through it in that sequence, and that's how the projects were identified as to which time frame they would be replaced. So coming to the capital improvement projects, basically based on all of those three components that I mentioned, which is looking at the hydraulic model, looking at the above-ground assets, and doing risk-based prioritization for the underground assets, we came up with 49 CIP projects, which include about 18 capacity-based projects and 31 R&R projects, and a total cost of around $167 million for the Water Master Plan through the horizon period of 2045. This is basically a cash flow breakdown of each of those through the next 20 years, how those projects would be prioritized. And as you can see, we are first prioritizing projects that relate to fire flow capacity, which relate to major above-ground aerial crossings at MacArthur as well as Venetian, and some of the booster pump station upgrades. And then we follow with some of the critical pipes that are buried and are at the end of their useful life right now. With this...
My rush to introduce, I didn't introduce him. This is Nanda. Hi. I'm going to talk a little bit about the wastewater.
Yes, I'll let Katie take over from here.
So for the sewer system master plan, we use the same approach as we did for the water system. We just skipped through this. We evaluated the pipe diameter, age, and material because that plays into its remaining useful life. We developed a model of the system that we used to evaluate the capacity. We identified several projects based on capacity of the sewer system going through 2045. As with water, we looked at the above-ground assets and identified some pump stations and aerial crossings that are in need of replacement or rehabilitation. And then for the underground assets, we have the gravity mains, which we evaluated based on infiltration and remaining useful life based on the age and material of the pipe to prioritize basins for gravity main projects. And then for the force mains, we use the same approach with the probability of failure and consequence of failure to identify sewer force mains and break those into the different time frames for replacement of the high-risk force mains. So putting all that together in a nutshell, we came up with 64 capital improvements projects. Most of them are based on R&R-based projects. There are a few capacity projects in there. And this is the cash flow of what it would look like over the next 25 years.
So I'd like to just add again that there was a lot of work that went into this, and we just went through it very quickly. And one of the big jobs was just getting the GIS layers. You see some maps there that have all the GIS for all the pipe inventory, the age, and all that goes with it. So just getting that all laid down was a considerable effort. The city really helped us out. Mm-hmm. And that's what, the way that we were able to go through it pretty quickly, the model.
On the sewer system side, you talked about the force mains, and the map was appeared to be a force main map versus a full system map. Mm-hmm. Did you look at the condition of, like, intra-neighborhood sewer system, you know, because that's one of our considerations, right, to feed into the Jacobs work is, as we go in with a neighborhood improvement, it's water, sewer, and stormwater. Mm-hmm. And so Jacobs is coming up with an algorithm, so to speak, on the, you know, the condition and the potential of all three systems, because we really only want to open up the roads in a neighborhood once. So in one neighborhood, it could be the water mains and the water pressure. In another neighborhood, it could be the sewer. And in another neighborhood, we could be experiencing severe flooding. And so we're going to have to figure out, well, who do we go to first? So in addition to the force mains, was there a study of the sewer condition within the different neighborhoods? Okay.
Forward, I think, Katie, to your the cash flow chart?
Yeah, okay.
So one of the things, the reason I mentioned the GIS is because now this is all in layers. So it's, we know Jason Bird, we know Lars Vanstack. We've already given this information to them. So you can see in the top right there, those are the force mains, pump stations, gravity mains are at the bottom. And so we have all the layers for what should be improved based on this study, and also what was to be improved in the R&R, and what the Jacobs folks should be able to do is take our layers, overlay them. Mm-hmm. The city also has a layer for pipe that you've already lined, for example, so that's in there. So there should be a good way to stack projects up and be able to see what got priority, for what reason, and what other work is going to be done in that area.
I want to ask, because when was the last time the city did an assessment like this, and what transpired after?
There's been a few master plans over the years. There's been a few water models, and work has come out of it subsequent to that. There was, going back 15, 20 years, there was going to be a pump station down at South Point that was carried forward to a certain degree and then modified. Then we did the improvement to take the pipeline across Government Cut. So there's been some developments that have led to different strategies, and then some of them have been implemented. Some of them sucked up a lot of cash. So you can see how some of them took priority, and then kind of the other things got kicked down the road. So this is just there's been several. This is the latest update to all that.
Okay.
Do you have anything to add to that, Mr. Cooley?
Oh, let me just add, we provided a draft to the city. We've gotten comments back. The numbers may change a little. We've got some comments on specific areas that we're going to look at the cost estimates and maybe some other locations, and then we'll provide a new revision at the end of the month.
Yeah. Commissioner, just to call out what Hayes and Sawyer identified, a lot of those water assets, especially those hanging off bridges that were showing a very high criticality of failure and likelihood of failure because of their condition. I would just submit to you that it's regretful. This is a product of deferred maintenance. You see a lot of these pipes that just simply over the last couple of decades have just not been maintained. You've got 20 to 40-year-old pipes that should still have a lot of life left in them, but we're having to accept the fact that they don't, and if we don't replace them, we've got lots of consequence of failure. And so if that answers your question, I think there's been decades of deferred maintenance.
Yeah, no, I that was my suspicion. I appreciate that. I appreciate the good work. This looks like in the bucket of have to do. You know, we just have to do things like this, and we're going to have to do some makeup. So my thought is where we want to go is probably send over to finance to think through funding sources, impact on operating cost, let the finance committee look. And then we have a very intriguing discussion, which Commissioner Alamon teed up, of intersecting these needs, water, sewer, with stormwater, and trying to figure out how that comes together, which is part of the Jacobs task order. So unless there's any other comments, I think we should go to finance with it, would be my recommendation.
We welcome going to finance, Commissioner. What our intention going forward is of course, we've reviewed the drafts. We have a presentation from them again next week to finish that item. Once we all agree on the information and finalize it, then what we would be prepared to do as staff is recommend to your finance committee a financing plan as to how we would get there, because you can see we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And if you I know they were trying to beat the clock, but it's heavily weighted in the first 5 years, even though it was a multi-decade plan they're presenting to you. The first 5 years needs the most substantial influx of money, and so we want to bring that plan to you.
Well, I mean, this is, I think, a critical, obviously a critical component. Thank you for your work, each of you, thank you, of what Commissioner Samuelin had asked for, you know, some months ago, which was sort of a recalculation on the whole neighborhood improvements program, mm-hmm. so we understood what the total nut was going to be. So certainly that makes sense. I think, you know, we probably won't do anything with that financial analysis until you have the Jacobs work,
right.
probably. But it does make sense. That's the right final destination.
Yeah.
And I know that you're working to make sure that all of the pieces are sort of recalculated in this way. So we've got a really good number, and we know what we need to put a plan around for the
and
next.
The real deliverable you have in hand today is your hydraulic models. And mm-hmm. from a water side, we've worked real close with our fire chief. And our fire chief's aware of it to make sure that we use our land planning zoning to be sure we have enough fire flows in all the areas going forward. So we have the most important knowledge now at our resource. So we know the information to go forward with, and that's taken a long time to develop.
So I would just say, Roy, when you're ready to come, I think we would favorably recommend that the Finance Committee review. Commissioner Malakoff.
Not only enough fire.
Yeah.
That'll come along with it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you very much. Let's see. I believe we did want to cover the artificial reefs, but that's Commissioner Arriola, so I'd like to wait a little bit on that. I see we have someone from FPNL here, so let's do a fun item, I think. Item number, you know, we've been wading through some heavy stuff, but I think this is sort of fun. And item number five.
And you've got me for like 10 minutes. I don't
okay.
know if we need to vote on anything today. You might want to.
Let's
pick a voting item otherwise.
Let's tee up this FPNL very quickly.
Okay.
That I think that'll be the next one to get to.
That sounds good.
Would you like to present for us?
Sure. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Flavia Tagnoli, Sustainability Manager. We actually have FPL here today. If you guys have any questions regarding their EV Evolution program. Right now, we receive a template agreement from FPL, and we are having discussions with our legal team regarding how we proceed with the agreement to be focused on EVs for our fleet, so EV stations specifically for our fleet. So that's where we are right now.
I had spoken to the gentleman at some length about the Evolution program. And it seems to me it's very important as the city gets new fleet vehicles, they will be electric in the future.
Yes.
And that there's a lot of chargers in that area where the fleet management is on Terminal Island. I think that's of the greatest importance. But the problem I had is that the ones that they're proposing to put in our various parking garages and lots, et cetera, take 12 hours to charge. And seems to me that we need a higher level, not level one or two, but at least a three.
Yes, I agree with you, Commissioner Malakoff. It's just that for the level three, the electrical infrastructure becomes a little bit more difficult. It's already a difficult for us to have the electrical infrastructure for level two for the existing garages that we have right now. So it just, like, for example, the one that we have with Tesla that it's coming right now, it's going to be a level three. But the program with FPL, they just provide level two at this point.
Level two, not level one?
No, level two.
Okay.
Yeah, which so takes about, it depends on the vehicle,
then?
But yeah, about 4 to 6 hours.
Okay.
Correct? So it's level two that they're providing.
What the gentleman suggested is that what it's going to be used is like to top off the electric. In other words, the car goes from home and he's going to the Trader Joe's. And Trader Joe's, at their garage, they have one of these. And so he plugs his vehicle in there. While he's at Trader Joe's for maybe 40 minutes, he's getting 40 minutes worth of a charge.
Yeah.
So it's just like topping off the gas in a regular gas engine. I guess it's all right. I mean, it's better than nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the level.
Well, it is.
Yeah, the level threes are definitely much faster.
Yeah, 45 minutes. You go into the store, you come out, and your electric vehicle is fully charged.
Yeah.
You go another couple hundred miles.
And that's part of the conversation we also have with FPL, that as technology evolves, for them to be evolving with the EV stations as well.
Can they upgrade them in the future?
Level 3 as well.
Can they upgrade them in the future, or they have to go start from scratch?
That's a question for them. Yeah, you can come up here, please.
Thank you for having me. My name is Dominic Versailles. I'm with FPL Development.
Can you move the mic closer to you, please? Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Dominic Versailles. I'm with FPL and the development team. They can be upgraded. Currently, what we're doing is we're having for a 7-year contract. Upon the 7 years, you could call and we could come and take it back. But to answer your question, yes, it can be upgraded.
Okay.
For the pilot program, it's specifically
for 7 years. And right
now,
you're putting in the chargers at no cost, but the city pays the electric bills.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes. And just to answer your question, to be a little bit more detailed, we do have level three chargers. However, we're specifically installing it near major highway corridors, only because from an evacuation standpoint, people want to be able to leave the state for an impending storm or hurricane. So we want to make sure it's closer to the highway.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And our fleet management is, in the future, going to be putting in electric vehicles. So it's important that we get several chargers there, but they could keep them for 4 to 6 hours to charge. I don't think that's going to be a problem.
Yeah, just think of it like your cell phone, right? You keep it on,
right.
You charge it. By the time you come back to work, it's 80 to 100%
right.
Full.
So I'm very excited about this partnership. It's a nice step forward with our fleet. We want to go electric. So my question is there anything you need now, and how soon can we be up and running? Anything in the way of us launching this program for the city fleet?
Yeah, I think right now we are reviewing the agreement with legal, so our legal team will be talking to a FPL legal team. And once we have something in agreement, I think we can come back to commission and just present it at commission. But that's where we are, because we want to be specifically for the city fleet, so that's why we are giving them some feedback.
I'd like to move that we go forward here so it doesn't have to come back to sustainability
sure.
again.
Sure, I'm fine with that.
There's too many committee meetings.
Yeah, you know, Raphael, from a legal standpoint, have we come across anything? And I know you're new in that seat, so if it's a follow-up, that's fine. Any roadblocks that we need to address, or are we going to be okay?
None. I reviewed the agreement that's in the materials, and it's fine. We'll just have a few tweaks, minor issues, but just clarification. But if you move forward with the program, we'll expedite the finalizing of the agreement.
That's perfect. I think Commissioner Malakoff's motion is a good one. We'll move to commission. Let's have some fun with it. You know, a nice partnership with FPL and, you know, nice step forward on emissions reduction.
Good.
By acclamation?
By acclamation.
Okay. Welcome, Commissioner Arriola.
Nice to be here.
Great to have you. And I think you have two items. You've got the artificial reefs and the Coca-Cola. Do we have the UM folks ready?
Yep, they're right.
We have UM in the house. So we'll start there, if that's okay with you.
Yeah. I'll tee it up.
Yeah.
A couple things. One is I had the great pleasure to go down to the UM campus on Key Biscayne for their marine biology department, And what I witnessed was, you know, one of the most spectacular facilities I've seen in all of Dade County, and I didn't even know it existed. And I think the professor will talk a little bit more about it, but learned a lot about how artificial reefs, you know, protect our shores from beach erosion, but also help break up wave energy to, you know, make our city more resilient and less prone to flooding and, you know, natural events like hurricanes or strong weather events. And artificial reefs are used around the world. The University of Miami is at the forefront of artificial reef technology. And I think we're going to have a discussion. I don't know if we have a presentation or not, but I think they want to brief us on what their research is showing. And I found it to be fascinating. It's something I think our city should really take a hard look at.
Can I ask one question? May I ask one question?
Sure.
I know you're going to make the presentation, but during the presentation, could you talk about the shape of the type of artificial reefs and whether it will help to bring more sand to our beaches as opposed to eroding it to have it leave our beaches?
Okay, yeah, we'll address that.
All right. Well, so we have the UM team here from ULINK. I'll let them introduce themselves and start the presentation to give you an update on the project. Thank you.
Okay, I'm Professor Brian House. I'm in the Ocean Sciences Department at the Rosenstiel School, Marine and Atmospheric Sciences. I'm also the chair of that department. And the other people that are here with me, let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Landolf Roth-Barbarios. I'm an assistant professor in the Civil, Architectural, and Environmental Engineering Department.
I'm Andrew Baker. I'm associate professor in marine biology and ecology. I presented here to you a few months ago last year with Diego Lehrman, who's also part of the team but not able to make it today.
Hi, I'm Jane Carrick. I'm a research associate and a staff member on the project. Thank you.
So what I'm going to be presenting, or what we're talking about today, is a combined approach to doing hybrid artificial and natural reef structures. And that's really the focus of this effort, is how do we enhance coastal resilience by using coral reefs and furthermore using hybrid structures that we can bring and deploy in locations that we can get the most benefit from them. And so this program is a development that came out of what's called the ULINK program, which is an initiative of the University of Miami to bring multidisciplinary teams together to address issues of importance to society. And as you saw from the people that are here and the people that are on the team, we have a group that represents ocean sciences from a physical perspective, like myself, and then ecologists and biologists in our marine biology and ecology program, as well as the civil engineering and also social sciences to understand adoption issues related to these types of structures. And the idea is that in addition to the known benefits of coral reefs for providing protection from storm surges from providing ecosystem services, being enhancing the value, the recreational aspects of coastal areas, there's also the impact that they have to protect that coastal structures and coastline from storms and erosion issues. So that's what we're looking at here, is how we can use these combined benefits from these types of structures to enable us to capture this combined benefit. And the goal of this is a research project. We're scientists in this program. We're doing research, and we're looking at how we can design these the best way possible to enhance all of these different impacts. And so the goal is to evaluate this impact on wave action and storm surge and identify sites that are optimal for doing this type of work. Now, we've been doing this over the last about a year and a half, and over the last few months we've been engaged heavily with the City of Miami Beach. Flavio Tanoli has been extremely helpful in this regard, as well as Elizabeth Wheaton, and we've met with Susie Torriente as well to discuss what the needs of the beach are and what we could be done along those in those regards. So, and to your question, Commissioner Malikoff, about erosion, the use of an artificial reef for storm surge resilience really comes through the reduction of wave energy impact on the shoreline. So that has, if the reef is there, that also has an impact day to day in the kind of erosion impacts that would be on the shoreline as well. So it's a cumulative impact of protection from all sorts of wind and storm events, as well as some protection from the more extreme events. So that's the main impact of having the reef, the artificial, combined artificial natural reef system there, is to reduce the wave energy, which protects from erosion and
overtopping. Professor, could one say that very much like Miami Beach itself, when it was created by nature as a sandbar to protect the mainland,
exactly,
a sandbar was created by nature to protect the mainland. Similarly, an artificial reef deeper underwater has the same effect of diffusing wave energy, which does a lot of damage to our shoreline.
Right. That's exactly right. I mean, the city of Miami Beach initially, you know, protecting the bayside communities or the inland communities from the wave energy, and putting something out there that can at least partially dissipate the wave energy offshore will protect the beach areas from erosion impacts as well.
And, Susie, I don't know if you know the answer. Many of us might. Ballpark what the county's estimating in the tens of millions of what it's going to cost to replace the sand on our beaches? Ballpark. I heard 30,
so 40. Through the project that we have happening right now, it's 15.9 million, I believe, or 15.3 in that ballpark. And right now, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is doing a feasibility study to understand what's going to be necessary over the next 50 years. And we anticipate that study to be complete in the next year, year and a half. And that's going to give information about the sand needs, look at different cost options, being trucking, if we can potentially look at international sources, as well as some offshore structures or breakwaters that you see, for example, at 29th Street. So that larger study is going to inform future beach management for the next 50 years of the federal cycle.
And tell me a little bit about the difficulty, maybe, Professor, you know the answer, but the difficulty we're having in actually obtaining sand. In general, isn't that a problem for us?
Currently, there's no longer offshore sand sources, and that's what we've used in the past. The current project that's slated to begin later this year is going to be trucking the sand in from Central Florida. However, it's much more expensive than other forms of renourishment, so any opportunity we have to reduce the erosional rates will help to reduce the cost of future renourishment.
I heard that for the first time we're going to be able to bring in foreign sand. Is that not true, like from the Bahamas or?
The foreign sand cannot be used for federal projects. And so
I thought that they changed, no?
It hasn't been changed yet.
Too bad.
And then tell me, is having a beach good for our local economy?
I think we all know. I think we all know that is, and yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, and to the issue of the sand sources, yeah, it's a real problem. And sand, there's, you just can't use any sand, as you know, and it has to be carefully matched to the local conditions for turtles, for the hydrodynamics, so it doesn't go away too fast. So it's a real challenge to find those sources. And so by deploying additional protective structures offshore, that can really greatly enhance the hopefully the lifespan of these projects.
Will these reefs, I've seen them in Japan where they're like X's and they're just concrete. You're recommending a combination of artificial and coral and natural. Will they eventually be local dive spots? I mean, could we, in fact, have a new type of recreation in Miami Beach as they do in some parts of the Caribbean where there's diving for...
I think that's...
Or diving to look at...
Ecotourism.
Ecotourism, basically.
I think that's one of the real opportunities here is that you could have that type of situation, because particularly in order to really increase coastal resilience, the advantage primarily, unless you're building a really large structure, is to have it close to shore. So we're talking about our test bed deployment to be in about 10 feet of water, so right around the edge of the swimming area. Good. Typically. So that's an area that could be accessible to snorkelers and things like that. And I think that's, and as it grows out to it being a vibrant reef-type structure, that would be a very exciting opportunity for that.
I encourage everyone to go see it. I didn't know this facility existed. It's world-class, truly world-class, and I can't imagine what that cost. And I think we got funding from the federal government. It's a beautiful piece of equipment. But what's groundbreaking about the work you're doing is, you know, it's truly first in its kind worldwide. Some of this research, I'm sure you're going to win prizes, but the ability to grow actual reef structures and put it on the artificial reefs and grow our own local ecosystem, this has a potential to not just sort of, you know, insulate us from a lot of natural events and protect our shoreline, but also bring ecotourism and also, I think, garner worldwide attention, again, for being cutting edge on research and deploying this research.
Outstanding.
Yeah, thank you very much for your kind words, Commissioner Ariel.
I was impressed. I mean, I want to give credit where credit is due. I love when our hometown and our hometown institutions are doing cutting-edge work that I think will be exported around the world and studied around the world. I'm being, you know, very serious. I was really impressed.
Yeah. One other note here on this subject is that as we get to this is the kind of design we're talking about to your question, and then if we go out, so these structures with the corals on them essentially also can keep pace with sea level rise, hopefully. As the corals grow on top of that structure, and as sea level rise increases, it's actually kind of keeps up with that is one of the advantages of this approach. So what we're talking about here is I don't know if you can see the dimensions on there, but these deployment of these structures, clusters of these different designs for the artificial part of the reef, then with the corals on top, about 18 feet long, in about 10 feet of water at the edge of the swimming area, over this area that encompasses about 100 feet of the beach. And that's for a research study on what are the most optimal designs. Can the corals grow well? How fast do they grow? And what is their benefit for taking out the wave energy at those locations?
And if I might just add something from the ecology standpoint, all those lovely little photoshopped corals in that diagram, those will all be restoration nursery-grown corals that will hopefully be potentially more resilient themselves to some of the climate threats. One of our scientists is also working on trying to give some sort of stress-hardening abilities to those corals as well. So just thought I would play that up since it's the environment and sustainability and
it's very exciting. With the dying coral, this is a way of regenerating new coral that's more resilient.
Absolutely. So it's really just merging the best of the restoration science with the best of the engineering.
All right. Thank you. So, Commissioners, we are working right now with the environmental agencies on the permitting and to identify the most feasible area in order to implement that. We just want to make sure that you guys are okay with that concept pilot for us to proceed with defining the area and full implementation of it.
Yeah, I think it looks great. Congratulations, Commissioner Ariola, for bringing this forward. I think it's very innovative work, and I'm fully supportive.
Do we need to take any action?
Do you need anything official from us?
I think just saying that you guys are okay with the concept for us to proceed with the permitting and identify the area with the environmental agencies.
Just okay. We're very enthusiastic.
We are.
Awesome.
We're more than okay.
All right. And you guys understand the sizes, everything. You're good, right?
We're good.
I think the only other thing that they wanted to mention, it's regarding funding for the pilot. Do you want to talk a little bit?
Well, for the initial phase of this study, we showed three different clusters. We've, through the University of Miami program, we have secured the funding for the initial part of that. Over the discussions that we have, which would be the design structures we've already tested in the sustained facility that Commissioner Ariola referred to, that's about $20,000 to do this build out test bed deployment. To do the full deployment with the additional two structures that you see there, which are testing some other types of designs, then would be about another 20K. So we're seeking external funding for that right now, additional funding for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Look forward to getting started on this.
Yeah, so congrats.
Yeah. I understand item number four, the...
Commissioner, I have a comment.
Yes,
how are you?
Thank you.
Luis Rodriguez, and a resident of 360 Collins Avenue. And I just like to speak in support of this amazing project. I'm not sure if some of you knew, but back in the beginning of 2000, ECOMP, while ECOMP still existed, we worked really hard with the commission to restore an existing nearshore reef that existed right between 4th and between 3rd Street and 6th Street. And it was a Garden of Eden. I'm not sure if you guys, the commission, remember. Yes, I have some pictures of it. And I used to swim. And when I moved here from California in 2000, I just could not believe my eyes when I went snorkeling down to the swim zone, and I could see this beautiful Garden of Eden with sea fans and near shore patch reefs full of angelfish, parrotfish, barracudas, you know, barrel sponges. It was packed, you know, all the way to 6th Street. And then back in 2002, I believe the U.S. Corps of Engineers and the county, they decided to do a beach re-nourishment project by the jetty. And unfortunately, the excess and migrated northwards and buried all the reef. And February 2002, I went swimming to the area and was gone, completely gone. So we had a lot of efforts in that area. It used to be designated as an artificial reef site. And have a lot of, I can share with you guys later if you wish, but have a lot of projects. And in fact, the commission passed a resolution at the time requiring the city manager of the city to allocate funds to restore the reef in that area. So I just like to lend my support to this proposal. And like I said, also besides promoting tourism and re-enhancing our local ecosystem, it would be an incredible, incredible opportunity for local divers and snorkelers and so on. So I'm 100% supportive of this proposal.
If you recall, I encouraged us to set aside some money in the geobond, $5 million, to actually create an entire reef system, artificial reef system off our shore, because, one, it's a resiliency effort, but secondly, for ecotourism, it's a huge opportunity, pennies on the dollar for what we could attract worldwide. Once the ecology sort of takes root, it would have been magnificent. So hopefully we'll be able to find the money to properly restore our reef system.
Comments as well, and it's, and also just like they mentioned, I've always been somewhat against the beach renewal projects. I mean, they're important, we need them, but it's something that we're going to be happy doing forever, you know. And we destroyed, you know, what we had that to protect our shoreline, and having these barrier reefs, what they do, they are, like they said, they slow down wave action. And by doing so, allows sand accretion, you know, so the sand to build up once again. I'm not sure if I shared with you guys, but also one of my specialties, my master's was in coral reef biology and ecology, studied in Caribbean and Bermuda and so on. So anyway, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Luis. I understand that item number four, our Coca-Cola, has been deferred. In the interest of time here, we will roll item number eight into our standard report. We'll cover that next time. So we're left with one item. And if I could get some help, I think we have a small video. This is item number six, the current status of the city's transition plan for gas blowers. And I'll tee this up, and there's really three sort of discussion areas. Number one is, what is the state of our transition plan? And with outside contractors, with our own use of gas blowers. So that's number one. Number two is to talk a little bit about the hours of operation of the city of gas blowers. You'll see a little bit of an incident that came up. And number three is, given the progress we're making with the public side of it, what might we do with the private sector? Do we need these gas blowers in the private sector? So those are the three buckets. Can we get the video real quick to tee this up?
Thank you.
Okay, that's great. So someone posted very early on Facebook. I looked at it quite early, circa 7 o'clock. They claimed that that was at 6:50 in the morning. So that was, sort of the timing issue that I want to get to. But let's start with the transition. At Neighborhoods, it was represented, and there's resolutions going back a few years stating that we are transitioning away from these noisy gas blowers. Could you please update us, Rodney, on where we are and when they will be done?
All right. Good afternoon. Rodney Knowles, Green Space Management Division Director. Where we're at right now is beyond the pilot study that occurred sometime in 2016-17, several departments in the city have been acquiring more and more battery-operated leaf blowers to comply with the resolution. For example, Parks and Recreation, Sanitation, Green Space Management. We have a few more units than we had back then. Right now, Green Space Management has managed to convert about 80 to 90% of its inventory. We're pretty small with the number of leaf blowers we have on hand, but we've made that move, and because our footprint is relatively small, it wasn't as much of an impact for us. With regard to our contractors, according to the resolution, our existing contractors were allowed to voluntarily make the transition, but when it came down to the existing contracts expiring and new contracts going out, the new landscape contracts that Green Space Management landscape contractors are working under and Parks and Recreation, there's language inside there that specifies that the contractors are to use exclusively battery-operated blowers instead of gas. We're withholding a few gas-powered units in-house for emergency purposes, for example, disaster recovery, et cetera, just to have them. But that's where we are today.
So just a couple specifics around that. It's very helpful. In terms of the city, excluding ones for emergency, which totally understand, in terms of our inventory, when will we not be using the gas blowers?
I can't speak for sanitation. We have the director here who will be able to opine on that. With regard to Green Space Management, we have enough battery-operated blowers on hand right now where we don't have to use them on a daily basis.
Hi there.
Daryl Caldwell, Sanitation Director. Currently, we have approximately 40 gas blowers, and we've been replacing them through attrition. Currently, we have 3 electric blowers with the extra battery backpacks and whatnot. And also, we've also had to retrofit some of our trucks as well so they can actually charge them on site. So, and again, our parts are going bad on some of the on the current ones. We are replacing them with electric blowers.
What's the time frame for the full transition?
At this point, the gas blowers are relatively, we are maintaining them internally. We've been doing that for years, and so we've been the replacement for them. You know, can be like 3 to 4 years for each one.
How about the contractors? Because that's something we can sort of mandate a little easier.
Sure.
When can we update our contracts so that there are no new blowers coming in?
Okay. The existing contracts expire in December 2019 for Green Space Management, for Parks and Recreation in January 2020, I believe. So by the time the new contracts are put out to bid, we receive those and it goes through the due diligence on our end, we can expect by the second quarter of 2020 that all landscape contractors working for the city on city-owned property will be using battery-operated blowers. And it's being conservative.
Second quarter 2020. And then just one other thing, I'll open up to my colleagues as we focus on our use of them. No one would want to be near, you know, something like that at 6:50 in the morning. It's just, you know, I don't know if you're an early riser. I tend to get up early, but that's pretty early. So I got a lot of complaints on that. Was that a policy violation? How do we ensure that we don't have people getting woken up like that? What do we need to do from this body to make sure that doesn't happen again?
Well, that was a sanitation crew. Our crews don't typically get in at 6:30. That's when they actually clock in. They fuel up, they get their supplies, and then they go to their particular locations that they do the work. And I'm assuming at that point, considering where that was on 11th and Euclid, coming from this area here, the 17th Street garage area, that had to be like first stop of the day.
Right.
And so, that it wasn't a violation of policy. It's just their typical work day.
So colleagues,
their typical work day starts at 6:30 in the morning, and the gas blowers could go right then. I mean,
well, no,
isn't there an 8 a.m.
There's
start?
A central location where all the employees meet, which is here across the street. Is where they come in and they'll speak to their supervisor. They'll clock in,
right.
Get direction, tailgate with their supervisors, and then that's when they go to their respective areas throughout the city. So that's probably 20 minutes or so and down the road. And actually, that had to be probably the first stop of that particular crew that morning.
This is not apropos of gas blowers, but when your crew is working on the medians, for instance, on Alton Road, is that part of what you all do, right?
Surface of the sidewalk?
I'm talking about the medians in the center of Alton Road.
Sorry to interrupt. If it's landscaping for the medians on Alton Road,
that
would fall under green space management. And typically, even though the language for the noise ordinance has an exemption for city employees performing work on city property, we typically, out of courtesy for the residents, observe the noise ordinance, and they're not allowed to start that work before a particular time.
What time is that?
They typically would start using power equipment sometime after 8 a.m.
Yeah, right. 8 a.m. makes sense.
Yeah.
But my question is, when they're doing that work, sometimes they put up the cones into like two lanes,
right,
instead of just where they're working, and it really does slow the traffic, often at 8, 9 in the morning, which is the commuting time. They just need to be more careful with, this has nothing to do with the gas blowers,
right,
but they need to be more careful with where those cones go so that they don't block traffic as much as they do.
Correct, and we've had to be...
still be safe.
Absolutely. We have to be creative with our landscapers because they typically start at about 6, 7 in the morning. So they're having to perform duties that, first of all, don't require the use of power equipment because of the noise ordinance. Second of all, they can't block lanes of traffic during rush hour. So within those parameters, they have to be busy prior to being able to now close lanes and start trimming the material within the hedge.
Maybe they should report to work a little bit later.
Which pushes their workday back, and then they have to complete and be off the site before people are leaving to go home in the evenings.
Okay. Commissioner Ariola.
Yeah, out of curiosity, what are the decibel levels, the difference between electric and gas, the decibel levels?
I don't have those numbers on me right now, but
anecdotally, is it significant?
It is not.
I think
most people who aren't familiar with these types of equipment, I think it would be difficult for them to tell the difference between a gas and battery. Where the environmental benefit comes from transitioning from gas to battery is with regard to exhaust.
Got it. A couple things. And I think part of the reason we were experimenting on the alternative parking in the Flamingo Park neighborhood was to actually work with our crews so that they wouldn't have to use gas blowers or any kind of blower. Because part of the reason we use it is because cars are parked where the leaves are to get the leaves out from underneath the car. If we move the cars, they have a much easier access to sweep.
Correct.
But I think that program's on hold. Is that correct?
We
got resistance from residents?
Yeah, that is correct.
They want to move their cars.
Yeah. So I think part...
We never lived in New York City.
Yeah, so part of the discussion we need to have, and I don't know how we resolve it, but that I think was one of the primary driving forces to test... pilot the alternative street parking so that we could address the other concern neighbors have about, you know, the crews that have to go through to clean our streets and sidewalks. I used to not be as sensitive to this because, you know, I get up really early and I think, you know, everyone should start their workday by 8 o'clock or whatever. But the truth of the matter is, and a friend of mine in the restaurant industry pointed this out to me, is a lot of people in our local economy work late hours, so they get home 2-3 in the morning, so they sleep in the morning, so they might be sleeping until 10 or 11 o'clock. So this is a big factor
for a lot of people, and now I'm much more sensitive to it, that not everybody gets up 6, 7, 8 o'clock in the morning. Some people sleep in because they work late.
Yeah. No, that's very helpful, Commissioner. I just feel like that's too early. Now, I know we got to get the work done, but 6:50 in the morning, I don't know. Is there anyone here who would want to hear that noise, whether it's gas or electric?
No, I don't think they actually start the machines, and I think they don't start them until 8. Well, usually.
Yeah, that's the city employees. He's talking about the city employees.
Yeah, I'm talking about the city employees. At least what was reported to me is that was around 6:50, and what I think I heard is they could. So can we stop that? Can we move it to 8? Can we adjust schedules so we don't wake up neighbors like that?
Commissioner, good afternoon. That's a loaded question. One of the things that we're trying to do for especially like commercial corridors is get them ready, clean, and opened up by 9 a.m. when people start walking in there, recognizing that there are establishments that close at 5 a.m.
Right.
So the window is small. We can certainly look to curb, especially in residential areas,
yep,
the use of any power equipment. And as Commissioner Arriola said, that was one of the benefits of that alternate site parking program was that it happens at a set time. It's from 9 to noon. It happens efficiently, quickly, so we can get in, get out, and I haven't increased my workforce. So we can certainly move and look to that direction to try and curb okay any noise within residential areas prior to 8 a.m.
That would be great. So I would like to just bring this back. Let's follow up on that discussion. And I understand, Jay, we've got to get work done, in particular in the commercial. But in the residential areas, 8 o'clock sounds a lot better than 6:50. And I would like to just see what the path, and I think you mentioned it's 3 to 4 years, what actions, if any, we could take to accelerate the transition. And if there's a dollar figure to that, there is. But could we bring that back next month and we'll discuss that? Would that be okay?
You okay with that?
Yeah. Yep.
That's what we'll do. Okay.
Thank you.
Please, Luis.
Okay, Luis Rodriguez again, 360 Collins. I appreciate that you guys are discussing this potential transition from gas to electric. I think it's a positive step and definitely in the right direction. I do like to bring up a concern. We discussed this item many, many years ago also in the Sustainability Committee. We had an attempted effort to even possibly ban them. Right. And I do understand the benefits of the leaf blowers. Now, one of my other concerns that we don't talk very much about are the particulates that the leaf blowers raise. You know, there's a lot of dust, it's a lot of pollutants, a lot of dried fecal matter. And so many times when, especially, I'm not saying the city stuff, but I see private contractors in parks and different areas, especially across the street from where I live on 4th and Collins, and using the leaf blowers and the amount of dust that it raises, and the people have to ask them to stop, you know, blowing the blowers, and, you know, and goes all over cars, but the people inhaling those elements. So it's another element of concern for people with respiratory, you know, challenges. And so once there's a lot of dangerous particulate matter, I like to, you know, to bring that up. And I'd love to see, you know, possibly, if there's any opportunity for us eventually, you know, to even to reduce the use of leaf blowers whenever possible. So that's, yeah. I know it's a challenge, but I'd like to bring this up.
No, thank you for that. And I think we will continue the dialogue. And for me, it's important before we talk about perhaps outright bans,
which
municipalities have done. And throughout the California, they've made incredible headway going away from these gas blowers. I think we have to just sort of get our own house in order so that we show we can do it as a city. And then it's a fair request to the private sector.
100%,
so that,
yes.
But yeah, that thought hasn't been lost on me.
Okay.
Colleagues,
thank you.
Any other questions, comments, anything else? No?
We have one more item on the agenda. I don't know if you'd like to defer or hear it. Discuss having the city, number 9, discuss having the city pursue mitigation project funding.
Thank you for that. Yeah, let's get a quick update on number 9. Thank you, Betsy.
Good afternoon, Judy Hohenschild, Grants Management Division Director. I just wanted to give you a brief update on the state and federal funding for mitigation and also what the city's done in the past and the plans for the future. It's a really a larger discussion on funding, a larger conversation on funding. We have two main sources of funding coming up for mitigation. They're both federal funding, and both fundings go through the state of Florida. We have the HUD mitigation funding, the funding that comes through HUD. It's going to be managed by the DEO, the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, and it's about $633 million statewide. The other source of funding is a FEMA funding. In the past, FEMA funds have been available to cities. It becomes available after a presidential declaration. This is the first year that we're going to have FEMA funding every year, so now it's becoming an annual program for FEMA. Just really quickly, what the city has in the past done well with the FEMA funding, primarily for city buildings, for public buildings, so for city hall, police station, fire station, fleet. We have received funding. We've done very well. We've hardened those buildings, mostly putting in impact glass in those buildings. Last year, we submitted quite a large number of applications for PDM, pre-disaster mitigation, and flood mitigation funding. We've so far been awarded three of those projects already, so just over $1.6 million, and we have a couple more in the pipeline. FEMA's still reviewing them. So we're very happy so far with what we've done with the last year's funding. The new cycle's coming up, and we, again, plan to submit applications. A lot of them will be for technical assistance, just so we can start larger projects going, but we do have projects that we will submit. The main issue with the FEMA funding is it really is aimed more at public buildings, so not so much for the private property, and that's where we really struggle. That's the funding that we're trying to find. FEMA really provides funding for what they call severe repetitive loss properties. So those are properties that, and the idea behind the FEMA program is to reduce the claims for the National Flood Insurance Program. So they're really looking at properties that have had two or more flood insurance claims and that have exceeded the market value of their home. So that's a pretty high level for us to reach on Miami Beach. The HUD mitigation funding, the second source of funding, is the new funding, and that's the one that we're very excited about. State of Florida, as I mentioned, DEO is going to be managing it, $633 million. HUD has already appropriated the funds, and HUD has appropriated the funds already, and they've also published in the Federal Register the guidelines. The stage we're at right now is that the state of Florida needs to complete an action plan and submit it to HUD by February of next year. So we're in the action plan stage of this process right now. DEO will be doing a lot of community workshops throughout the state. We intend to be very, very involved in those community workshops and surveys. We have our legislative, state and federal legislative consultants working with us on those, on getting our funding. And really, one of the things that we want to do is we really want to secure funding for things like private seawalls, private properties, things that we haven't been able to get funding for through the FEMA funds. That is our plan. So step one is to try and is to attend these workshops, get our voice known, mm-hmm. complete the surveys, have as much help from our legislative consultants to get our projects in the action plan. Action plan will be delivered to HUD in February of next year. And at the same time, we're working very closely with the CRO and Environmental, Public Works, CIP, on our list of projects, so that when the funds are available, we have a strong list of projects that we can move forward with. We know that Miami-Dade has been designated what's called a distressed area, so that's really good for us. 50% of the funds have to be spent in that area. And they are looking through HUD at future needs, so that's really important to us. It's not dependent on what's happened in the past, so potential mitigate projects that could potentially mitigate. That's where we are at the moment. We do plan to come back to the committee once the action plan has been posted.
That's great.
With an update.
Thank you for that update. I put this on as a referral because I heard of the HUD funding. Just the cost of resiliency is enormous, and we as a city and our taxpayers have been paying the whole thing. So here's a program where the feds have actually found $630 million, given it to Florida. We deserve our fair share. So I would sort of close my comments with, is there anything we can do to help at this point? Is there anything you need?
Our key goal right now is to get our projects or the type of projects that we want funded into the action plan. So we'll work through the administration to get our projects and through the commission as well to get our projects in the DEO action plan. Once they're in the action plan and approved by HUD, then we can suggest these projects. So the first step is, as DEO creates this action plan, we need to have as much input as possible.
Very good. Colleagues, questions, comments? Please, let's get our fair share here, and let us know if we can help. And let's keep it on the agenda for an update at the appropriate time.
Do we want to add this to the work plan and then bring it back through that venue?
We'll add it to the work plan when you have a relevant update on the, particularly the HUD, that's job one, but any others and anything we can do to help spread the word. You have a survey going online, right, on Facebook?
We've worked with communications to get that survey out to our residents.
I did my survey.
Thank you.
So if you need us to help spread the word or do anything like this, please let us know. Miami Beach shouldn't have to shoulder all the burden as we have, and we need to get these outside sources of funding. So thank you for your efforts. Thank you, colleagues. Commissioner Arriola, great to have you. Raphael, welcome. And it is 4 o'clock, and that's for today. We will not be meeting in November, so our next meeting will be in December. We'll have a couple new folks up here. Thank you.